interior. Oficjal była wie, odpalamy przeciory and it's executed. Welcome to this industry workshop. We have decided that we should have a two-day induction of the standing committee on finance, and there is a program in front of you, which is a two-day program. Today and tomorrow. It is quite very important for us as members of Parliament to be capacitated in doing our oversight work, because we have the constitutional responsibility to play oversight on the executive arm of government. Chapter 4 of the Constitution bestows powers of oversight on the legislature, legislative authority, and in this regard is the Parliament. And Section 44 of the Constitution outlines the powers of the National Assembly. So the Constitution vests the National Assembly with the power of oversight over the executive. This is further outlined in Section 55, subsection 2, that outlines the oversight powers of the National Assembly, whereby the Section 55, subsection 2 provides that the National Assembly must provide for mechanisms to ensure that all executive organs of state are accountable to it and maintain oversight of the exercise of national executive authority, including the implementation of legislation. Also, we have to play oversight on any organ of state. So the Constitution recognizes that legislatures have a critical role to play in overseeing better performance in the delivery of services. So by this induction workshop, our objective is to improve the capacity of the portfolio committee to hold the department and their entities to account for their performance. So we believe that by the time we leave here tomorrow, we will no longer be the same. We'll have been better capacitated to understand better the role of treasurers and the entities that fall under that department. So members, officials, Deputy Minister, you are welcome. By those welcoming remarks, the workshop is officially open. I'll right away request the Deputy Minister to make a political input and overview, and also an overview of the presentations that are going to be made. Yes. Honorable Sir.
Yes. Why under you part this CIC part of the program?
Remember, Reserve Bank, we are going there next week, so we can explain on the point.
Because we need to know what's
happening with EPS, EPA,
and PIC.
Okay, but I think the DG will give an explanation in that second. Thank you, Honorable Schwab. Deputy Minister, can you make a political input and overview?
Yeah.
No.
I don't know, but I thought the department would quickly take care of the question so that you are fine with it before the minister continues, and unless the department wants to do it.
No, sir, thank you very much. Morning, all members. I take it that, Chair, this is your program, and in terms of who you want here is the chair, is the committee's prerogative. Ideally, there's no reason why they're not here. Ideally, they should be part of the process, unless it is a scheduling thing, but yeah, I'll just check with Cindy, but Honorable Zwamba is right. I mean, they are entities of the treasury. And if we are taking you through what we do and how we do it, they must be included. So there's no, I can't think of any other reason why they are not here. Cindy? Yeah, no. I think I was right, Chair. There's no reason on our side not to have included them, except that if you look at SARS, there's an oversight visit next week, and that's the same way that we are going to take it. In terms of the PIC, there is a communication between ourselves and the Secretariat. Again, we don't have an issue with that. With GPAR and GPS, the same. As part of the oversight visit, then the committee will exercise their role and understand what they do, etc. So, from our side, there's no issue. All of the entities can be here, should be here. But if the committee felt they will engage them on site in their own backyard, it's a different story. But there's no reason why they're not here, except for those two reasons. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, honourable members. Thanks for inviting us to this orientation workshop in which we as the finance department will be explaining ourselves on who we are, what we do, why we do what we do, and how we do it, and also get comments from you on how we should do what we do in line with the constitutional legislative framework of our country. We're meeting here in the context when the economy is not doing well, which show in many microeconomic indicators, employment, growth, GDP per capita. You'll recall that the first quarter, the economy declined by 3.2%. And if the economy is not going, it means that business is not investing. And if there's no investment or the rate of investment is low, it has huge implications insofar as our ability to generate jobs, insofar as our ability to generate revenue, which is important for us to provide the services that we've got to as the government, as well as investing as government ourselves in growth-enhancing activities. So we are not in a good space in the current moment insofar as the economy is concerned. And Chair, it shows in our physical indicators. Of course, as National Treasury, we are responsible for microeconomic policy coordination. I must underline that because other departments and other institutions are responsible for execution of other policy levers of the microeconomic policy. You know better than I do that the Reserve Bank is responsible for the monetary policy. Other departments are responsible for the labor policy, trade policy. But as Treasury, we are responsible for the macroeconomic coordination of government insofar as the microeconomic policy is concerned. But our main strategic instrument, which we've got control over, of course, control, but also guided by yourself as the representatives of the people in the legislature. And the challenges that we have in the economic growth or performance, they show in the fiscal policy. If you look at our fiscal policy today, on the revenue side, the rate of generating revenue is estimated to be low going forward. So we are going to have serious challenges insofar as revenue collection is concerned. And I'm sure when you meet with our colleagues who are responsible for SARS next week, they will take you through what are the both objective challenges and institutional challenges related to our ability to basically generate more revenue. If you look at our expenditure again on the fiscal policy, there are challenges. Our wage bill is high, the debt service costs are also very high, and we are capitalizing SOEs, bailing out SOEs in many respects, and there are questions that have been raised by the rating agencies and by yourself as well on the state of the state-owned entities. It's not just rating agencies that are raising questions as far as that is concerned, but the public and yourself, you are raising questions about where should we prioritize? Should we continue to bail out the recapitalize the state-owned entities at the expense of service delivery, health, education, and so forth and so forth? But if you look at the capital structure of ELCOM, for instance, their liabilities are very high compared to their equity. I mean, if you read today, even their financial statements ranging from the balance sheet, financial, income statement, the cash flow, the ratios are not well balanced. And there are challenges indeed insofar as the SOEs are concerned. And we will rely on your guidance on what are the things that we need to do insofar as some of the challenges that we are facing around our fiscal policy. And of course, my colleagues here, we'll take you through on the things that we will be doing or we are doing as National Treasury, even though some of these entities, they are under the Department of Public Enterprise, but we do have a significant role as National Treasury to basically turn the situation around. I can go on and on insofar as the challenges which show up in our fiscal policy, the borrowing that we are basically challenging, we are facing insofar as the fiscal policies are concerned. I'm saying this just to lay the context that we are not in a good situation. There are serious challenges insofar as the economy is concerned. The National Treasury, we are responsible for 16 entities that report directly to us, and a few of them have challenges. SARS has just emerged out of the institutional instability in the past, and they are doing their best to make sure that they restore the institutional capacity of SARS to do its work under the current difficult conditions. And like I said, when you meet them, they will take you through how they are repositioning SARS to basically perform its constitutional and legislative function. Chair, I just want to say in closing that we will rely on you to turn both our economic situation around, and if there are challenges in our institution, we'll also rely on your guidance, your oversight, and critical support in the that we'll be doing as the Department of Finance. We are looking forward to working with you in order to turn the situation around, to grow the economy, and make sure that we provide jobs and other services to South Africans. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Deputy Minister Dr. Masondo, for the overview. I think FIC is ready to start with their presentation. So we'll right away request the head of the Financial Intelligence Center to present. The Mokuru asked. Okay, you'll be the first one. I'm sorry, I just come to FIC. Mr. Marshall, make a presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we thought we can just quickly take the committee through the Treasury and its role and functions. I'm looking at the presentation. Look at slide number 2 of the presentation that has been distributed. Mainly, as it's known, Treasury is established as per the Constitution, Chapter 13 on General Financial Matters broadly outlines what we do and what informs us. Essentially, those five blocks on your left, we coordinate financial and fiscal relations, we manage the budget process, we enforce the efficiency in spending, efficiency in financial management, assets and liabilities, and we also promote fiscal coordination and macroeconomic policy. And finally, we ensure that the stability in the financial system and financial services in the whole of government. That's broadly what the Constitution says we should do. And in doing that, obviously, government finds, we find expression in what government wants us to do as per the mandate. And we have there broadly what our vision is as a treasurer and what we want to do and how we want to do it. And then we government has committed itself to those 7 priorities, and we then work within those prescripts as outlined in what government wants to be doing. The PFMA, furthermore, section 216, as I say, slide number 3, broadly establish the treasurer, as I said, and show compliance with all of the subsection 1 and the transfer of funds to any of the states, including ACF, and the way those funds are managed. So generally, hold us accountable jointly with specific organs of state in terms of management of finances. So we take our role broadly as being that. And then in doing that, we obviously have to work in collaboration with this committee, as the Deputy indicated, where you then jointly and individually have to hold us accountable. Broadly again, section 217 talks about procurement, which is a responsibility under the Treasury, where we have to ensure that we make sure that the procurement process of government fulfills what the requirements in national issues are about in contracting goods and services, and that it must be in accordance with a fair, equitable, transparent, competitive and cost-effective process as government procure services and goods and services generally. 218 also talks about guarantees, where guarantees as per the Constitution can be approved by the Minister of Finance, including the remuneration of persons holding public office. The PFMA in particular also talks about the fifth section, section 6, around functions and powers, and basically giving expression and further responsibility as per general financial matters in the Constitution. Coming to this committee, obviously, will be various pieces that ensure that there's effective coordination of fiscal and financial relations. We manage the budget process. Also important is 1E there, where we facilitate the implementation of the annual Division of Revenue Act, Division of Revenue across 3 spheres. We also monitor the implementation of how provinces budget and municipalities budget and extend their budget, and that's also in line with what the MFMA says. Slide number 6, we also just a continuation of what I was saying. We also have clauses specifically that talk about banking, cash management, investment framework. We can invest that money on behalf of government. Short-term, on a short-term basis, we manage the cash, including the banking services, etc. We also are responsible broadly to consolidate financial statements, meaning the signing of financial statements for the whole of government and the whole of public entities also is our responsibility, including aggregations and financial statistics. We also manage the National Revenue Fund. And slide 7 broadly talks about mission and vision, and those priorities is slide number 8, as I indicated. We've got 8 programs, so the 10 programs essentially, in terms of fulfilling our functions. Economic policy, firstly the administration, where the ministry and the office of the DG and the corporate services are situated in. We've got, and all of these divisions are and should be headed by a DDG. We've got Mr. Momoniat, who's responsible for economic policy and tax and financial sector policies, where most of some of these institutions will find expression to in the department. So he's going to be a client of this department together with myself. Program 3 looks at budget matters, where that's where the budget office is at, public finance, looking at the national departments and intergovernmental relations, mainly looking at provinces and municipalities. Marijan Malin is the head of that division. Program 4, assets and liability management. Call it a debt management office, because that's what we have become lately. Headed by Anthony Julius, he's also permanently as a DDG there. They will engage with rating agencies, they will engage with local and foreign investors, they will raise bonds, they will manage the cash. They will also play an oversight role, financial oversight role, on some public entities, mainly those who are having guarantees, because guarantees will be generated from this division. So it's quite an important division in that, as I said, it's basically responsible for assets and anything that's assets and liabilities for management. Financial accounting and supply chain management systems, headed by the acting accountant general, William Achebula. They're responsible for all supply chain, and they basically give effect to Section 217 of the Constitution as it relates to procurement matters. Currently, they are engaged and with ensuring that the new public procurement bill is outlined. It is in the cabinet system currently, and we hope soon it will be published for public comment, as it's going to be processed later in Parliament. So, modernization of financial management systems, procurement systems, will be emanating from that division. International financial relations, headed by Voyela Vumendlini. Essentially, there is all your financial relations with many a country, including SADC, including SACU matters, including African Development Bank, New Development, BRICS Bank, World Bank, AIIF, Asian Investment Bank, and the IMF. So all of our relations, financial relations, so far as those DFIs and organizations are responsible, that unit will be looking at that. Civil and military pensions, contributions to funds, and other benefits. Basically, this is to ensure that pensions are paid, statutory pensions are provided for, and that program finds expression in the Treasury also. Program 8, Technical Support and Development Finance. GTEC used to be actually be housed in there, but it's a separate, and that's why they're here, they will engage them directly. Revenue Administration essentially is where SARS, this program essentially just transfers resources to SARS, almost 9 billion a year in terms of SARS budget. Program 10, Financial Intelligence, Space Security, same thing here. FIC, again, their budget will be transferred from here, including space security budget, because the budget of space security is in this vote. So again, anything and everything that goes in there is essentially the responsibility of those accounting officers, and in consultation with them and jointly with them, we'll obviously be able to account to this committee and other committees in Parliament in terms of their spending. So, Chair, I thought we should take you through this and generally just say the Treasury is there at any given point in time. we will, where we sit, based on our reach across the whole of government, we will and we should be able to know at least what's happening in each agency in government, which is a difficult task. There's 1,100 of us. It's not easy, but our role, we play an oversight role on government organs of state as a whole, and we and the treasury in the division called public finance, where Dr. Mampo Modise is the DVG there, they will play an oversight role on us as a department in government because of the delegation that exists. So in one instance we are regulated by a DVG and I'm accountable to this DVG on financial matters as they relate to the department. So there's a funny relationship, but so far it hasn't been a problem because we understand the roles and the responsibilities of that division vis-a-vis my role as DG of the Treasury. And most functions are delegated. There's an effective set of delegations, stacks and stacks of documents where the minister delegates responsibilities to me as per the Constitution and as per the PFMA. And in some cases, then some of those delegations further goes to all these 10 DDGs who may be generally responsible. So it's not in all instances that and I'm not giving an excuse up front as in terms of how we will engage and how I will relate with the committee, but essentially, one has to make sure that as part of the sixth administration, we play much more, and in my particular compared to previously, I play a much more meaningful role and supportive role to the committee in executing its functions, in passing legislation, especially around key matters around the financial sector, which still needs to be reformed in a big, big way to fulfill the mandates that we have. So, Chair, in a nutshell, that is who we are, and we definitely will be available to the committee as and when needed. Thank you.
Thanks, DG, for outlining the mandate of the National Treasury. So now we can take the question. Are they ready? Okay. Request the aid of FIC to make a presentation. I'll request because I don't see names of. They just write head, CEO head. Which one is it? Yeah. Where are the names? Where is it? The other?
Who's the head of FIC?
Oh, so the presenters will be Peter Smith and Dr. Michael Masiapat. Okay. Over to you, Doctor.
No, thanks, Chairperson, members of the committee, Deputy Minister and DG. Just for record, the Chairperson did receive a written apology from the director of the FIC, Advocate Golisile Kanyile, who had a medical condition. And on that basis, she had therefore requested myself, Mike Masiapata, who is the executive manager responsible for analysis, together with Advocate Peter Smith, responsible for legal and policy, to take the committee through the introduction of the Financial Intelligence Center. So with your permission, Chair, I would like to just contextualize in terms of how we are going to be introducing the Financial Intelligence Center in the context of what is seen on slide 2 on the screen, and also in terms of how we are going to be taking through the presentation. According to the program, we are allocated 20 minutes, I suppose, as it were, and we shall definitely stick to the time as allocated. I will be taking the committee through the background of the FIC, basically reflecting on the contextual existence of the center and the kind of the functions that we do as the center. And then Peter Smith will take the committee through the framework, that defines the South African anti-money laundering, as well as countering the financing of terrorism. We basically refer to that as the AML CFT regime in the country, and he will be clarifying the committee around the legislative context that defines that part of work. And he's also going to touch on the domestic as well as the regional footprint of the center in terms of the work that we basically do. Then I will come back to then conclude the presentation in terms of our key output, which primarily reflects on the kind of work that we then provide out there, and will basically reflect on the context through which that is done. And then we will basically conclude by reflecting on the prioritization mechanism. So when we go to the next slide, which is slide 3, members, we just want to put it upfront to say that we are a Schedule 3A public entity as the Financial Intelligence Center. As you will be aware, we actually were established in 2001 by what we refer to as FICA, or the Financial Intelligence Center Act, as it were. But we effectively started operating in 2003, around Feb. And it was around that period when we started receiving, which you will then get the context as we move, what we describe as the suspicious or unusual transaction report that comes from the role players that we will define very soon, who are responsible by law to send those suspicious transaction reports to ourselves as the center. And of course, in terms of the existence or in terms of the establishment of the center, we are the only entity in the country that is legislatively authorized to receive as well as to analyze suspicious financial reports, and out of that be able to generate what we regard as the financial intelligence reports to stakeholders, particularly law enforcement and a lot of other role players. So in other ways, we are the national center, you know, as it were, primarily responsible for gathering transactional data in the country, and ultimately, as indicated, provide the report, as it were. We have put that line there so that we are able to really have that broader strategic appreciation of the center by indicating that we are not one, an intelligence agency. As you will know, intelligence agencies in the country, as established by the National Intelligence Act, we are not that. And secondly, we are not a law enforcement agency. That is in the context of, for instance, the police service or any other stakeholder that sits on the other side. But we are, obviously, as indicated, a center, as we do transactional issues as it relates to finance. Of course, we are financed by the fiscals, and of course we are reporting to the Minister of Finance, and mainly accountable to yourself. So if you can just look at slide number 4, committee members, just to have some broader reflection in terms of what is it really that that we do. One, we want to indicate that we are in a way sitting between the private system of the country and the law enforcement part of the country as the Financial Intelligence Center, primarily because any other role player in the country that has to do with the financial transactional kind of business, and typical examples in this context will be the banking community, for instance, they have that responsibility to provide information to ourselves on the basis of anything they consider to be financially suspicious in terms of how the transaction might have unfolded or anything to that effect. So we basically receive that and ultimately analyze that. And we basically analyze that using a multiplicity of other data sources, which you will understand very soon as we touch into that. But part of the responsibility that we have is to also ensure that all the critical role players in the entire financial family, you know, as it were, in the country, is compliant to the provisions of the Financial Intelligence Center Act and all of the various regulations that are provided for in line with the Act, as it were. But the key genesis of our establishment is to be able to identify the process of crime. And that is the main essential existence of ourselves, particularly with the view to ensure that we combat money laundering in the country and beyond, and at the same time also ensure that we deal with any possibility of the financiers of terrorism. We have to be making sure that those role players are therefore, in a way, dealt with or addressed. At the same time, we are also responsible to ensure the implementation of financial sanctions, particularly those arising from the listings that are done by the UN Security Council. And that becomes one of those critical roles that we actually have to do. And ultimately, as indicated, is to also ensure that all other accountable institutions on the other side do comply to the legislative provision, you know, as it went. So slide number, the following slide, really, committee members, seeks to reflect on our locus in the broader criminal justice system in the country. And we consider this slide to be very critical, primarily because we seek to, in a way, make the committee members understand the context that we are not on the other side. We are in the genesis part of the criminal justice system, particularly from your financial crimes point of view. And that is why we do reflect on the fact that accountable institutions, or what we regard to as reporting institutions, which as indicated, typical example will be the banks, are basically responsible for sending through what we call regulatory reports. And we have basically put in abbreviations there, but those abbreviations basically mean suspicious transaction reports. They have to be sending them through to us. What we call cash threshold reports, they send that through to us, or international fund transfer reports, or TPR, those are terrorism property reports. All of those then get sent to ourselves. Our responsibility, therefore, is to receive that and ultimately be able to also use other data sources that are available in the country. Typical example there, for instance, is the DIS data, or data as it relates to the registration of companies and all of the various other data sources held by government in particular to be able to generate what we call financial intelligence. And then ultimately we then provide that to law enforcement as it were. That is primarily the context through which our establishment is based on. But again, for contextual purposes, when we issue this report, we basically have categorized them in two main groundings. The first one is what we call proactive financial intelligence reports. Those are the reports that are issued out of the volition of the Financial Intelligence Center on the basis of the information received, which gives possible rise of a possible unlawful activity, and therefore we give it to law enforcement to look at. But the other part is when law enforcement is busy doing work in a particular issue, then they can be able to send a request to ourselves to be able to do financial analysis and mainly follow the money to be able to contextualize the work that they do. And ultimately, we provide that to the competent authorities as provided for in Section 40 of our Act, and therefore they are able on the other side to do actual investigations, actual prosecutions, or even for future orders, as it were, in cases of the proceeds of crime. And ultimately, our responsibility in the bigger scheme of things is to ensure that our financial system stands in tolerance of abuse and that it is therefore not utilized unethically. The next slide, which is slide number 6, just do provide those key accountable as well as reporting institutions that I've referred to earlier for broader contextual understanding. And that is, for instance, the ASEC agents, the banks, attorneys, the gambling sector, the motor vehicle dealers, as well as forex dealers. These are critical role players in the private space that are mainly identified as the possible, you know, groupings that could be easily abused for possible money laundering. And that is why they are, by law, supposed to be reporting to us once they pick up any activity that borders on possible illegality in terms of financial transactions. And once that has been reported to us, as I've indicated, we follow through the process with the ultimate view of making sure that those role players actually get addressed. So now we then move to slide number 7. As I've indicated, Peter Smith will then reflect on this slide that in a way describes the legislative grounding through which we operate by. Thanks.
Thank you, Martin. Good morning to members and to Chairperson. In this slide, but we try to convey the message that the FIC Act does not operate in isolation. It actually supports the implementation of two other pieces of legislation. Firstly, the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, which is the legislation where the act of money laundering is made a criminal offense. And in the same legislation, the provisions for the forfeiture of proceeds of crime and instrumentalities that are used in crime are provided for. That legislation is under the administration of the Department of Justice and is mainly implemented through the powers of the National Prosecuting Authority. The second piece of legislation that is supported through the application of the FIC Act is the anti-terrorism legislation, the Prevention of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorists and Related Activities Act. We call it PAKTARA for short. In this act, the act of financing terrorist activity or terrorist organizations is made a criminal offense. The act of terrorism itself is described in that legislation. And also the measures to address the financial sanctions emanating from the United Nations Security Council against organizations such as Al-Qaeda or ISIS are provided for in this legislation. This piece of legislation is administered by the police service. So these two pieces of legislation are not under the FIC's control, but the work that the FIC does and the work that Dr. Masapata discharges now is directed at enforcing the implementation or enhancing the implementation of these two pieces of legislation. And as a combination, these three legislative instruments provide what we call the framework in South Africa to deal with money laundering and terrorist financing. Then on the next slide, number 8, we identify the types of institutions that the FIC regularly engage with, firstly domestically, and these cover a range of institutions both in private and public sector. So for instance, in the public sector side, we cooperate very closely with those that have investigating power, such as the Special Investigating Unit, the Police Service, DPCI, the Directorate for Public Crimes Investigation, or Priority Crimes Investigation, the Public Protector, the National Prosecuting Authority, and the Revenue Service. And then there are a few others that are also listed in the Act. In Section 40 that perform those investigative type functions that are entitled to receive the analysis information from the FIC. We also cooperate very closely with the entities in the public sector that have supervisory functions. In other words, those that are responsible for regulating parts of the financial sector and for supervising that the entities in the financial sector to make sure that those entities comply with their own legal obligations. So here, for instance, we talk about institutions such as the Reserve Bank, and within the Reserve Bank there are actually three separate components that have each a supervisory function over a part of the financial system. The first is the Prudential Authority that supervises the banking sector. The second is the Financial Surveillance Department that supervises the international movement of currency and also protecting the value of the rand and or supervises institutions that are in the business of dealing with foreign exchange or international funds transfers. And the third entity within the Reserve Bank is the National Payment Systems Department that oversees the institutions that process our financial business on the payment system and make sure money moves from one person's account to the other and ends up with the intended recipient within a short space of time and very efficiently, etc. In addition, we also cooperate very closely with the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the successor now to the old Financial Services Board, and this entity supervises the non-bank financial sector. So they are responsible for supervising insurance business, for instance, or financial investment advisors, traders on the securities exchanges, and so forth. All of those institutions have their own obligations under the FIC Act, and these supervisors are responsible for doing the inspections and imposing sanctions where institutions do not comply with the FIC Act. So in the private sector side, on the domestic level, we cooperate very closely with entities in business itself. For instance, we are able to obtain very useful information from the South African Fraud Prevention Service, for instance, or the Insurance Crime Bureau. We have memoranda of understanding with these institutions that allows them to provide information to the FIC where we need to contextualize a person's financial profile, for instance. And this information is very useful, again, when we perform the analysis work based on the reports that we receive. At the international level, we are, South Africa is a member of an organization that's called the Financial Action Task Force. This is an intergovernmental body that sets the international standard for systems to deal with money laundering and terrorist financing, which South Africa subscribes to as a policy matter, and therefore South Africa is also a member of this organization. And we try to implement our anti-money laundering system according to the international standard that's set by this body. And within the FIC, we are also closely involved in the South African representation in this body and the discussions of the work that happens there. Then on the next slide, number 9, this continues the regional footprint and the international footprint of the FIC's work. South Africa is also a member of a regional organization called the Eastern and Southern Africa Anti-Money Laundering Organization. This is a sister body to the Financial Action Task Force and subscribes to the same standards that are set by the Financial Action Task Force and promotes the implementation of those standards within countries that are not members of the Financial Action Task Force but are situated in the Southern and Eastern Africa region. The membership you'll see there in the table, you can see it covers almost all of SADC and a few more countries from the East Africa community. Those that are marked in red in those blocks are countries that have counterpart organizations to, or actually all of these countries have counterpart institutions to the FIC. So they have similar financial intelligence units in their own countries that do the same type of work that the FIC does here in South Africa and with whom we can exchange information on an operational level. Those that are marked in red are members of the body that I'll mention next, the Egmont Group. The Egmont Group is an international organization for financial intelligence units worldwide, so sister bodies to the FIC here in South Africa in, I think it's about probably close to 160 countries now around the world are all members of the Egmont Group. And the purpose of the Egmont Group is to provide a means for these institutions to exchange information with each other, and also provide a secure communication system for that. So if we are following a transaction that originated in South Africa and we can see the money went to another country, in this, let's say Hong Kong for instance, we can send a request through this network to our counterpart organization in Hong Kong and ask them what do they know about that transaction, or is the bank account and known as it's been reported to them, etc. So within the African, Eastern African, Southern Africa region, we have this means of communication with those institutions or our counterpart institutions in those countries that are marked in red, for instance. This is a very key focus of the FIC's work, is to enhance the capability of these bodies in our region to become members of this international network, because that helps both those countries and ourselves to exchange information more securely with each other and to improve the quality of the information that can be exchanged. And then that helps both ourselves and our neighboring countries to deal with a common threat of financial crime that spans our borders. Then on slide 10, I think just to sum up from this framework point of view, the areas of the FIC's work that spans from the start with the actual implementation on the administration of the FIC Act. Here we work closely with the National Treasury, for instance, where amendments need to be made to the Act to promote and advise on those. To improve the levels of compliance by our financial sector with this legislation, which is where we work closely with our supervisory partners. Then to produce the type of information that our law enforcement agencies required in order to apply the criminal justice system to investigate criminal activity and bring those to prosecution. And finally, to enhance our own efficiency as an institution and internal operations by improving our own systems, for instance, our analysis capability, our IT systems, etc. So these areas also broadly align with the strategic programs in our strategic plan that we present to this committee annually and that we report on in our annual report as well. So with that, I'll hand back to Dr. Masipota.
No, thanks, Chair. Just in the remaining 5 minutes, with your permission, Chair, let me then conclude by just reflecting on slide number 11, which basically tries to contextualize the workings around proactive financial intelligence reports. The reason why we wanted to also have this very clear is just to indicate the complexity and the intensity that is applied to us having to come up with a proactive financial intelligence report. By the way, in terms of the reactive one, it's not much of a complexity because it's truly a request that we get from law enforcement that we need to do some work. But in terms of the proactive one, this is basically the context or the process through which that, in a way, we follow. One, as I've indicated, we do have a multiplicity of regulatory reports that get submitted to ourselves. But at the same time, we also use the open source platforms that are available in the broader electronic space that we also juxtapose the regulatory reports that have been received. But at the same time, also look into the feedback that we receive from the various stakeholders that we provide reports to on the basis of the priorities of the country that has to be dealt with, particularly the leading, I would say, vulnerabilities of our financial system for possible money laundering or for any other criminality. And also we get guided by the national intelligence priorities arising from national intelligence estimate, which primarily comes from the intelligence community. But of course, more importantly, we are also guided by the financial intelligence threat analysis, which starts to give us what are the key financial threats that we are actually dealing with as a country, what are the key vulnerabilities in our financial system that get exploited, and we put all of those together, and therefore we are able to then put through a mechanism to start a process. And in that context, we use our data technologies to be able to go through a multiplicity of data, primarily to be able to generate areas of vulnerabilities and issues that require attention. And out of that, we select a particular matter. And once a matter has been selected, we then create a case. And once case has been created, we then do the collection of a multiplicity of data sources and ultimately then prepare a financial intelligence report. For the purposes of context, each and every report, we then subcategorize them on the three main levels: high priority, medium priority, and lower priority, for the purposes of the kind of work that we put on the ground and the kind of effort that we put on the ground, and ultimately do the dissemination to law enforcement. The slide that follows, which is slide number 12, is basically just to indicate to yourselves that even the context of prioritization is not done by any subjective individual. It is done out of a metric that is, in a way, an international grounded metric that is primarily used by a multiplicity of financial intelligence centers globally. And that is to indicate, for instance, if the matter is of terror in nature, for instance, if the issue is relating to money laundering, or if the issue is relating to illicit financial fraud, for example, we give each one of those matters a mark, and then ultimately we are going to add up all the marks. Anything that falls between 16 and 18 is therefore regarded as high priority, and therefore the resources we put on it becomes different than the matter that sits between 12 and 15, which becomes medium priority. We then also have a particular level of focus, and of course the lower priority will be issues of getting a mark of 6 to 11, and therefore it's lower priority, and therefore we handle it as such. The last slide, Chair and committee members, we just reflect just the bigger picture, not in terms of just the past financial year, because we are finalizing our annual report as we speak, and that is why we didn't want to talk to that before it is published. But this is just an indication in the 2017-2018 financial year, just to indicate, just for contextual purpose, that we sat with over 330 suspicious and unusual transaction reports that actually get reported to ourselves. Out of that, we have to follow the process, as I've indicated, to come up with a particular issue that needs to be worked on. Over and above that, for instance, cash threshold reports, we received over 4.8 million. And by the way, cash threshold report means any transaction that is sitting above 25,000, where somebody goes around with hard cash of 25,000, drop it into the formal financial system, or take it out of the formal financial system, that gets reported to ourselves, and out of that we are able to make a determination if that is a honest transactional issue or there is any possible criminality. And once we pick up any criminality, then we process it further as it were. In terms of the registrations, we are just indicating that all the role players in the private system that actually deals with finances, we have more than 40,000 that are registered with ourselves who actually are providing those reports that I've indicated too. And therefore, the interventions that we were part of in that financial year, we had around 55 million as it were, and in areas where we activated the asset forfeiture unit within the National Prosecuting Authority, and we retrieved money, and that money has to be put back into the state, was at around 3 billion. And I think you'll be aware that some of that money goes into what we call CARA Fund, which is the Criminal Asset Recovery Fund, and some of that money goes into the National Revenue Fund. Those that the one that goes to the National Revenue Fund is truly administrative, and the one that is criminal goes to CARA, as it were. And we were involved in 37 judicial actions together with law enforcement to make sure that we deal with the role players. We had over 2,200 in that financial year requests for financial intelligence coming from law enforcement, which we had honored, and that is besides the proactive ones that we worked on. And of course, we just indicate also that we have done over 800 inspections across the various role players, particularly motorbike dealers, in order to make sure that they don't become vulnerable to money laundering and anything to that effect. So that then brings us to the end of the presentation, and that is, in short, what the FIC is. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Dr. Masiapat and Dr. Smith, for the presentation. Let's move to Government Technical Advisory Center, GTEC, acting head, Ms. Lindsay Bell.
Thank you, Chair. And greetings to the committee members. I am accompanying me here is Ms. Tilitinali, who's head of our strategy, and my consultant, who's our CFO. And greetings to our DMMDG, the National Treasury. So the Government Technical Advisory Center, I would say, is one of the youngest of the family of the finance community. So we have here a very brief presentation that will take us through what it is that we do, what our mandate is, how we fulfill our mandate, our role and responsibilities, the scope and services of our business offering. So if I can just launch into it, the next slide. Okay. GTEC, in short, draws its mandate from the responsibility of the National Treasury, and you would have heard that the DG mentioning that somehow we still have a footprint, or one of our feet is still in Program 8 of the National Treasury. Our mandate and strategic objective is to assist organs of state in building their capacity for efficient, effective, and transparent financial management. Our functions really can be summarized as they are listed in our founding notice. The first is to render technical consulting services to the center of government departments and the organs of state, to provide specialized procurement support for high-impact government initiatives, to render advice on the feasibility of infrastructure projects, to provide knowledge management for projects undertaken by GTEC itself, and anything that obviously relates to these functions. In fulfilling our mandate, GTEC consolidates all of National Treasury's, or at least most of National Treasury's, advisory and support activities through a dedicated center with skilled expertise for improved governance through a separation of regulatory from advisory support, for improved service delivery through a single entry point, enhanced coordination and quality of service to the public sector, and optimized performance through strategic performance to innovate, learn lessons, and upscale interventions to govern. So when GTEC was established, it was really to establish it as a lab where we could test out certain interventions, and then if they work, we upscale them to the rest of government. We are, next slide, we are a component of the National Treasury, so unlike FIC, we don't have an act establishing us, we're not a public entity. I would like to think of ourselves as a government component acting as an entity, and we can come to that when we have questions. But we established, obviously, in 2012, in terms of the Section 7A, 4 of the PSA 1994, we provide services to our clients by authorized law through agreements with the National Treasury, first and foremost, the other center of government departments, and those would be DPSA, DPME, COPTA, in addition to National Treasury, and obviously other organs of state. Okay? The way we do our work typically is by us getting a request from the initiating department and then entering into an agreement to provide the services that relate to the core mandate of the Center of Government Department. And GTEC is prohibited to compete with the private sector. So we, even though we provide consulting services as part of our mandate, we don't compete with your typical private sector companies or consulting firms. Next slide. Our role, our role also emanates obviously from the NDP and the MTSF, and our role lies in building a capable state. The work that we do is in support for inclusive growth to stimulate employment and income-generating opportunities. We enhance private sector participation in infrastructure investment, job creation, and finance development. We strengthen the strengthening of institutional governance, planning, and resource management to achieve value for money and sound public administration. We support stakeholder partnerships in city development, education, social services, and economic development. We support the development of policy analysis, public economics, and evidence-based public finance advice to meet the needs of the National Treasury. The scope, next slide, the scope and services that we provide can be summarized in five areas. It's the research and policy analysis, transaction advisory services, project development and appraisal, management support to government departments, and program management functions. The business offerings that we have, if we can list them, and I think in this instance I will also give some examples as far as possible. In conventional procurement and PPPs, we provide transaction advisory services on PPPs. This is support to infrastructure, where we get involved in the planning, feasibility, and cost-benefit appraisal, financial analysis, competitive procurement, and contract negotiation for PPPs. This is the support that we provide to the organs of state, where we facilitate engagement between departments or spending agencies and the Treasury on project plans, budgeting support, and then also around PPPs, we run training and support to government departments and municipalities around project planning, preparation, procurement, contract management, and then we support, we obviously give support to provinces and municipalities on PPP projects. There are examples that we have here which are not part of the presentation, but we've been involved in Gautrain office accommodation and various other PPP projects that we give support on. In institutional strengthening, we provide public management, organizational development, and social in social services. Much of the work that we do relates around strategic planning support and OD support to departments in feeding function shifts, where, as an example, now you've got departments that have meshed as part of the NMOG. We are getting involved more and more in assisting departments to basically move the functions that are supposed to now go to other departments. We provide project management services and public finance management advice to departments. And in terms of our priorities around social services, these include better school management. We've got a big project in the Eastern Cape looking at rationalization of schools and other projects around functions. At the moment, we do some work with Department of Higher Education as well. Skills development and further education partnerships, health services management and the implementation of national insurance, and then support to the social security reform and implementation. In terms of economic development work that we do, we are involved pretty much in the economic development support, infrastructure support and human settlement. We provide support for regional and local partnerships between the public and private sector to accelerate investment, job creation and integrated special development. Our priorities around economic development include the strengthening of development finance institutions, developing small enterprises and fostering sectoral development partnerships, facilitating communities of practice for regional economic development, and cooperating with municipalities in local planning and economic development. Is that my time? Okay. And then you also asked that we provide we support integrated human settlement development by promoting housing investment and associated infrastructure services and management support for infrastructure delivery. And here, in particular, we are assisting, we've got quite a significant support program with the Provincial Treasury of Limpopo, where we are assisting departments, we've been asked to come and assist departments with them spending their MIG, the Municipal Infrastructure Grant, appropriately, because as you know, one of the problems that departments are not spending on infrastructure as much as the budget for them. Okay, in terms of the public expenditure and policy analysis, here we are supporting National Treasury's budget reform and policy advisory responsibilities. We do what we call public expenditure reviews, and I think we've done about 40 of them to date, where we look at how departments have spent their money and where savings could come. And also what we do as part of this work is to basically cost policies, how much it would spend to implement particular policies. Right. We also have work around capital project appraisals, where we basically, again here in support of National Treasury's budget processes, we are looking at assessing infrastructure or spend on infrastructure in doing project evaluation, infrastructure planning, and enhancing collaboration between national, provincial, local government and state-owned companies in the development of network industries, energy, transport, water, and communications. The big part of the work that we do here is to also look at the projects, the big capital projects that come through National Treasury in terms of the budget facility for infrastructure, and assisting departments in making sure that the projects are ready. And some of the work that we'll be doing mainly there is to make sure that we do some preparation for making sure that projects are ready in the planning and ready for financing. And then almost finally, we do program management, and here we provide the implementation support to large programs of the National Treasury, the two main ones being the Municipal Finance Improvement Program, MFIP, where we are placing technical assistance in provincial treasuries, as well as in the National Treasury for various areas or game-changing projects around finance management improvement. And then the second big program for the National Treasury that we are implementing is the Jobs Fund, which is aimed at creating jobs in South Africa in various sectors. And this is a program that was started some time ago, and it was capitalized by 9 billion rand to basically leverage private sector and provide mesh funding for the creation of jobs. That would be GTEC in a nutshell. An updated project here. The other thing that I missed out of this presentation that was submitted earlier is the work that we do around public economic capacity building, where we are basically working in partnership with institutions of higher learning, higher education, to implement a public economic pipeline, to build a pipeline for new capacity for GTEC and National Treasury, where we are training young economists. We're running an annual winter school. We just completed the fourth annual winter school for young economists and master's graduates who then come in to do internships in the Treasury and in GTEC. We are looking at upscaling that to the rest of government, but conversations are underway at the moment with the National School of Government as well as possible donors to carry this program through. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ndala, for the presentation on GTEC. Let's take Cooperative Banks Development Agency, CBDA, Mr. Dumo and Ms. Saul. Over to you.
Chair, thank you very much. And also, I want to thank the committee for inviting the CBDA to make this presentation. My name is Jabrin Dumo. I am the acting person of the Bank Development Agency, and I'm accompanied by Ms. Nomadelo Saulu, who is the managing director of the agency. What I will do, Chair, is to just take very shortly, it's not a long presentation, the committee through the presentation. I will touch on the mandate of the CBDA, the role of the CBDA, the strategic pillars of the agency, and then also we will touch on the status of the sector itself, where it is situated at this juncture, and then also we will then touch on key policy development and some legislative changes that we are envisaging moving forward. With regard to the mandate, CBDA was established in terms of the Cooperative Banks Act number 40 of 2007. It is a Schedule 3A public entity funded through the fiscal report directly to the Minister of Finance, and it is currently housed within National Treasury. In its policy, it is guided by the policies developed by the National Treasury Tax and Financial Sector Policy Unit, and it has a board of directors, and it has the managing director and the staff. It manages its operation through the following legislative framework: the Public Finance Management Act, Treasury Regulations, and also the Labor Relations Act. The functions of the CBDA is to support cooperative banking institutions by providing them with capacity building initiatives. It seeks to enhance cooperative banking institution operational capabilities through banking systems. It then also facilitates and promotes and fund education and training to enhance those cooperative banking institutions. It also promotes register and regulate representative bodies. Those are the right bodies, because if you look at the CFIs, when they are established, they are primaries, secondaries and also tertiaries. Then at the tertiary level, we are dealing with those representative bodies of the cooperative institution or cooperative banking institution. It also accredits and regulates those support organizations. In terms of its vision, it facilitates financial inclusion, economic transformation, and financial sector competitiveness through cooperative banking. Its mission is to develop the cooperative banking sector through provisions of innovative capacity development, support to cooperative banking institutions and their members, and then it also promotes cooperative banking in South Africa, the entire South African landscape, the cooperative philosophy and its principles. It enhances operational capability, discipline in the cooperative banking sector through the introduction of the innovation and technologies. And I think my colleague will then, MD will then, after I've articulated the role, he's going to take us through those strategic pillars of the agency. In terms of its role, it seeks to create an enabling environment for the cooperative banking sector in the country. Cooperative banking has a very critical role to play. It really provides fair competition within the banking sector, reduce inequality, because you know the cooperative banks and also institutions are also well placed to mobilize the marginalized members of our community in South Africa, and then it also contributes to the economic transformation both of the banking sector and also assist in the economic transformation of the economy as a whole, and then it also assists in financial inclusion for South Africans. And then I will hand over to my colleague to take the committee through the strategic pillars and all our programs that are being implemented, and even also articulate the status of the sector currently. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Members, thank you for the time. The name is Namadelo Fauli. I'm currently the acting MD of the CBDA, not the head of the CBDA. The board is still in the process of appointing the permanent head of the organization. So as the CBDA was established in 2000 and the act was enacted in 2007, we had our first board in 2009, we started operations in 2010. So we had to quickly find out what is on the ground. How are these cooperative banking institutions operating? We then learned that according to law, CFIs must have 200 members in place. So a community will identify a need for banking services because they are far from the next town where they can access financial or banking services. Then the law says you must be a cooperative first. You must be registered as a cooperative. You must have 200 members. You must have 100,000 in share capital. Then we can entertain your application as an entrance into the banking space in South Africa. Then you will be called a cooperative financial institution. Since when we started, we developed a curriculum in terms of financial management, governance, because now we're dealing with board members that are in those rural areas that are running these banking institutions, but they've got no idea how to play an oversight role in a banking institution. So we had to start training them on governance, we had to start training them on financial management, on playing an oversight role in terms of internal audit and all those aspects. So now what we are saying is we are learning as an organization as well. We are saying we need to transform the business of these cooperative banking institutions by ensuring that we've got the right people in the right positions. But that is very difficult because even for them as the CFIs or cooperative banking institutions, it's very difficult for them to raise capital, for them to be able to employ qualified and competent and experienced people to run these institutions. As a result, they end up taking the treasurer in the church to run this bank. So those are the challenges that we are faced with when we are trying to assist these cooperative banking institutions. So we are now looking at holistically supporting these institutions through our new approach, which is called the Holistic Cooperative Banking Institution Support, where we're looking at first starting by putting systems in place. We started a project called the Banking Platform Project, which was funded by the Department of Small Business, so that the CFIs could have a banking system. That is where they need to start from, because currently they are operating manually. If you go to any cooperative banking institution now in the country, they would write on a piece of paper that you want to deposit or withdraw 50 rand, unlike other commercial banks in the country that are operating out there. So it doesn't make the sector very attractive. So it's the first thing that we are doing. We now have about 15 of these cooperative banking institutions that are participating in this banking platform that the CBDA is subsidizing. The next step is to ensure that they are connected to the national payment system. That is what we are talking about when we are talking about business transformation, in terms of also bookkeeping and record keeping. So that program is now at an advanced stage. They are now going to enter the national payment system. Absa Bank was appointed as a sponsoring bank to assist this sector in entering the national payment system. And then in terms of training, we're working with the University of Porto, we're working with the University of Pretoria in terms of formal training. And then we are introducing peer learning so that those that are experienced, the CFIs or cooperative banking institutions that are experienced, can actually do peer training amongst their members. And the most critical aspect is branding and marketing. We don't have a budget to actually go out and create awareness as CPTA. And as a result, we rely on word of mouth. But now we're identifying stakeholders that we could work with that could assist us in this regard. Our main program is capacity building, where we ensure that CFIs, as soon as they get the license from the Prudential Authority at the Reserve Bank, they undergo some form of incubation where we take them through how to run a cooperative bank by providing them with a cooperative bank in a box. It's a tool that shows them what the manager is supposed to do on a daily basis, what the tellers are supposed to do on a daily basis. So it's a new tool that we developed in the past financial year, and in this financial year we're starting the rollout on all the 22 CFIs that are registered. And then we are going to perform intrusive monitoring just to make sure that the numbers that we are getting when they are reporting in terms of their prudential numbers to the Prudential Authority are accurate, reliable numbers, because we found out in the past that they just submit their reports, their quarterly report to the Prudential Authority, but when you actually go to the bank, there is no money. So those are some of the challenges that we have met with in the past. And now we are saying, when you are submitting your report, you must make sure that you submit also your bank statement so that we can make sure that the members' deposits are actually safe and sound. The main project that I was talking about, which is the main banking platform project, it looks at ensuring that there is a national cooperative bank or a tertiary cooperative bank, that where the CFIs or the cooperative banking institutions will be banking into. One of the complaints of the cooperative banking institutions on the ground are saying, even though we are called cooperative banking institutions, we still take our money to the commercial banks. So that defeats the purpose for us. We want an institution where we can all bank at as our own cooperative bank. So that's where we are at. So that is the vision going forward. in terms of facilitating the establishment of that national cooperative bank, where they all, in terms of their sectors, bank. Currently, CFI members cannot access their funds if they are outside the where their CFI operates. And if their CFI or cooperative bank closes at 5 p.m., they cannot access their funds. So this is one of the challenges. If they go to Cape Town on holidays in December, they still can't access their funds because they've got no access to the ATMs or any point of sale in the country. So this makes it a challenge to the cooperative banking members. Hence, it is very important for us to have this network where they can communicate with each other through this banking platform that CBDA is currently facilitating. Currently, we've got three cooperative banks in the country. One is in Orania in the Northern Cape, the other one is in Phakamise in Richards Bay, and the other one is in North, the other slide will show that table there with the cooperative banks, yes. So we've got three in the country, one is in Phakamise, the Phakamise is called the Phakamise, it's in Richards Bay in KZN. Then the other one is in the Northern Cape, it's called Orania. And then the other one is called the Dzobotla. It was formed by the members of or the employees of Lafarge Cement. It's in Northwest. And then you've got about 22 CFIs. So before you become a cooperative bank, you start by becoming a cooperative financial institution. In the past, the differentiator was that the CBDA used to regulate these institutions. But now the Reserve Bank, since the enactment of the Financial Sector Regulation Act, has now taken over the regulation of these institutions. So now they are all regulated by the Reserve Bank, by the Prudential Authority. So we've got 22 of those, we've got about 26 in the country. So in terms of deposits, those are the numbers that you see there. We've got about 294 million in terms of deposits, and about 369 million. This is still at its infancy stage compared to the credit unions in America, because this is what these institutions are called in America, and they are in trillions of US dollars. So the question is, why is the sector not growing in South Africa, or, you know, taking traction as we would like it to? Hopefully, that question would be answered by the work that the World Bank and Rabobank are currently undergoing to develop a national cooperative banking strategy, as this was one of the recommendations of this committee in 2017. So CBDA and the National Treasury, actually National Treasury requested World Bank to assist in this regard in the development of a national cooperative banking strategy. Then the World Bank appointed Rabobank to develop the strategy, working with the CBDA and the cooperative banking institutions. We are hoping that in the third quarter of this year, we will bring that draft national cooperative banking strategy in this house, and it will have recommendations in terms of what model should perhaps adopt as South Africa, and what are the business models that the CFIs themselves or the cooperative banking institutions can adopt to make sure that there is growth in the sector in terms of capital and sustainability. Then the other work that is underway also as part of the recommendation of this committee, when the committee said it's the strengthening of the legislative and regulatory framework. So CBDA, together with the Prudential Authority, we worked through some new rules that are more progressive for the cooperative banking sector. And I think, again, when we come back, we will be able to report more in terms of the work that is being done in this regard. Thank you.
Chair, that is our case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dumas and Mr. Chowley. Those are the four presentations made so far. The presentation by the DG, Treasury, presentation by FIC, GPEC, and CBDA. Now is the time for question and answer. So I will invite members of the parliament to ask questions or make comments. So let me note those who want to ask questions and make comments. Honorable Abraham, Honorable Mazilati, Honorable Phil Lewis, Akbar, myself, and course, Butelezi, and course, Kupan. He's the son of a chief. Okay. Let's start. Welcome, Honorable Mbrolo. Honorable Brown.
Yes, thanks, Chair. Chair, indeed, the input has been very enlightening. And as a result, thank you, the mic. Delivered by the EFF. Thank you very much. Okay.
Oh, the ANC might work better. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. No, the chair will help me finish. Okay, thanks, Sam. Chair, I wish to appreciate the input. And I was just saying that as a result, my questions are only clarity-seeking questions. The first one is to the DG. As mentioned in Program 3, my question is how the role of the intergovernmental relations performed, especially in local government institutions. I have in mind here the local government institutions where municipalities, small municipalities that are struggling have been brought together, and in most cases they are found to be ailing even more. What is it that the department is doing to assist those municipalities? I think that the decision to bring them together was a good one, but what then is the intervention at this point? My second question, Chair, is on Program 7, where it talks to the issues of civil and military tension. My question is whether the department is satisfied that at that level the performance is good in terms of covering the deserving pensioners, and if the DG could talk about the relations between that program and probably PIC. And then to SIC, I got scared when that section presented, because it for me it sounded like SIC deals with a lot of sensitive issues. My first question would be then, how do we at that level ensure confidentiality? Number one. Two, the combating of money laundering beyond the borders of our country. Now, what kind of capacity is there in the department to take care of that? And how do we create awareness to the public around? You know, sorry, I thought I had voice. Okay. Then, as I said, then when the financial intelligence report is ready, who receives it, and how do you then deal with follow up on the report that you've given? Say in a situation where there's no consequence, no action, how do you then follow that up? I also saw that on the vulnerable sector that you mentioned, the pension fund is not a mentioned vulnerable sector. Is it because it has not been identified as such? Comrade Peter Smith, I could see on your face that you are a comrade, wherever I am. Can I check if there's capacity within FIC to deal with individual cases of money trafficking? My question there was whether it has to be entities that are involved, or do you also deal with individuals as well? That was my question. Chair, quickly going to GTEC, they talk about enhancing the private sector participation in infrastructure investment. Now, for me, that talks to job creation, and in fact, you did talk about job creation and financial development. How would you elaborate on that in terms of the impact on the larger scale of the national development plan? You also mentioned the rationalization of schools in the Eastern Cape. I'm interested, coming from the Eastern Cape, who you work with there, and in terms of institutional arrangements, and what are the details thereof? My next question is whether a GTEC mandate includes the empowerment of communities in the accessing of job funds or other funds that are available. How are communities able to access information? You talk also of the winter schools. Are there any spin-offs from those winter schools with the higher education sector? The last sector that I want to pose questions on, Chair, is the CBDA. They talked of the reduction of inequality. My question is, what the scale of success is in this regard? How has your work dented the overall inequality status of our country? We still regard inequality as one of the giants. We still talk of it. How are you denting that CBDA? Now, there's also mention of ABSA. I'm not surprised that at the end you are saying that the cooperative banks are still frustrated by the fact that they still work with the old banks, because you have also placed ABSA as, I don't know whether you said it's the main bank or it's the coordinating bank or what. Why? Can I get clarity on that? What is their role? And what stops members from being able to access their funds from the system? What are the difficulties? What is your success story? Thanks, Chen.
Thank you, Chen. I also welcome the presentations. They were very much educating. I have a comment or question on the CIC, more especially about the suspicion of unusual transactions. When you spoke about the 5,000, just as little as that. My question is, we know that we've got stock fell, what we say, Mokodisano, in South Africa, and they exchange a lot of money, more than 25,000. How do you track those? How do you know that this one is Mokodisano, or just, because I can imagine it will lead them to go now and bank their money under the beds in the houses. So how do you deal with those? And again, on the cooperative banking, the last one, when you spoke about cooperative banking, we also have people that are doing stock fair. Do they know about this? Because they also have
you know, a lot of money that they exchange every month. Because I know about the corporate bank, you also have to bank money every month. So do they know about this? The advocates.
Thanks, Chairperson. How many entities does National Treasury? So the department of 16, but I've got 17. So, like, the how many entities do you have? And I want you to maybe deal with this, that how many are established by law, and how many are established by proclamation? And how many are just components of National Treasury? I think that clarity must come out clear, because I think that the sixth parliament should deal with entities that are established by proclamations and make them to be established by law. Specifically, the GPF and GPA, I think there must be a parliament enacted legislation that establishes those entities properly, so that the accountability mechanisms are clearly defined. So that is an important component of what we should clarify. But also we should deal with governance issues as it relates to SARS, to GPA, because there are no boards of governance there. There are no boards. There's a loosely defined relationship between either the CEO or the commissioner with the Minister of Finance, which is not very clear. So part of the things that we need to deal with, Jay, is to clarify that relationship, because you've got a SARS commissioner who is appointed by a president but must account to the minister, and when they disagree, then the commissioners will easily say that, but you never appointed me, why should I account to you? So that relationship should be clarified in terms of whether we shouldn't consider putting a board for the revenue collector, so that the much more closer mechanism and oversight mechanism. Because I mean, a board would otherwise deal with many other issues, including remuneration, policy, and committee. But now the minister can't be the one that determines the salary scales and levels of the commissioner and other executive managers in the manner in which the design is now. I think that the issue of entities under National Treasury should be clarified, including its relationship with the Reserve Bank, so that we know to what extent do we oversee the responsibilities of National Treasury towards all those entities. I'm not sure if I heard you properly, DG. Did you say that as DG you are accountable to DDG? In terms of I thought you had mentioned something like that. I thought you had said something that in terms of but I'm thinking that the programming of and the allocation of DDGs somehow concentrates power in certain offices. We've raised this before, and it was taken out of context that we're attacking Ismail Momonia. He's got too much power and responsibilities more than the DG. He literally owns the National Treasury and oversees literally everything. And it's one of the issues that we have raised before and we're raising again now. When we raised it before, we raised his race as well. No, we're not raising his race, we're raising the over concentration of power. Anyone, even if it was any other person occupying that position, the concentration of responsibility in one office, it's not a good design of the National Treasury. And in relation to the FIC, what is the role of private banks in the enforcement of FICA broadly? Do they have investigative powers? Do they have enforcement powers broadly? Because I think there is a different understanding of how the FICA should be implemented now, with banks thinking that they are the new sheriffs or the law enforcement agencies and convening people for interrogations and all sorts of things.
in terms of issues which otherwise were supposed to be dealt with elsewhere. Perhaps we need to have that clarity so that we know what happened. And you say, you emphasize that you are not an intelligence agency, but you're called a financial intelligence center, and you're not an intelligence service. How do you gather the information? Where do you get the information about the money movements, and what mechanism do you use to gather that information? And once you have referred the matters, let's say to the Directorate for Primary Crimes Investigation, the HOG, and then they don't do anything about it, what do you do? And how many cases have you referred to the HOG as the FIC? I know of one where we reported the case to the police about a person who had a bank account in Canada, and the FIC wrote to us to say that they investigated and they referred the matter to the Hawks, and that the outcome was positive. But the Hawks say that no, we don't have such information. What happened there in terms of those issues? And in terms of GTAC, the you say that part of your responsibility was to administer the jobs fund. So there's never been a report to Parliament about the performance of the jobs fund. So there's never been any table to report that says that this was the amount allocated, this is the number of jobs that were created, these are the recipients of the money, the 9 billion that was allocated for jobs purposes. Maybe you must give us that overview now, so that we have got clarity of what is the impact of this jobs fund? What exactly have you done, and how many jobs have been created as a result in terms of all these things? And the clarity in terms of GTEC is whether your transaction advisory services and consulting services are extended to municipalities, more so when it relates to expenditure of infrastructure grants. Money do you assist municipalities as well? And CBDA. I don't think it exists, but it's there, like it's a decoration. Like. Yeah, it's just there, like it's just for there, but I don't know for what this is, because it doesn't have oversight authority. The powers were taken to the presidential authority, and they say it must train people. That's why we've got three cooperative banks, which amount for probably less than 0.1% of the banking space. I think it's a waste of time, really. I think there must be a fundamental redesign of the whole thing of cooperative banking. Maybe a discussion must happen on what is the redefinition of cooperative banking. But as things stand, the CBDA is a waste of time.
Thank you very much to all of the colleagues who have presented. A few quick questions. The idea, this is a question to the FIC, the idea of lifestyle audits is an idea that has been long discussed in South Africa, but seems to be for the first time an idea whose time has come, and it is starting to be discussed very seriously in government circles. There is at least one provincial government that has begun to implement lifestyle audits across the board for elected office bearers and for senior levels of the civil service. I see that it is being seriously discussed, and I believe even that possibly a tender has been issued for the conduct of lifestyle audits in the senior echelons of ESCOM. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm sure I did read that. This is fantastic news. It's absolutely necessary, and it strikes me that the FIC is exactly the body that is empowered to be able to conduct these lifestyle audits, not only, as you say, sir, reactively when you're requested to do so by a law enforcement agency and you conduct a kind of audit of a person's bank account, but actually proactively on an annual or biannual basis, and that helps with the problem, as you said, of coming up with a proactive work agenda given the complexity of the South African financial system. So I'd really like to know from you whether, and perhaps to you as well, DG and Deputy Minister, whether this is something that government is seriously considering as a meaningful, very helpful step in combating corruption in the state, and whether the FIC could be empowered to undertake this task on behalf of government on a regular basis. I just want to link that to the scoring system that you outlined in your presentation, which is very helpful, and say that, well, I would propose some amendments to that scoring system, not that we need to discuss those in detail now, but where does that scoring system come from? Is that set down in regulation, or is that something that you have just developed internally to guide your decision making? Because, for example, I think that politically exposed people, or I think they're called politically interested people, should get a much higher rating than 3 points on your scoring system. And that should almost move them into a category of compulsory scanning and auditing on an annual cycle. That's the first question on lifestyle audit. Then secondly, just on your success rate, I just want to ask you directly, obviously it's very important that you focus on corruption, but have you done any work with SAPS or the NPA in tracking down gangsters, and in particular I think of drug gangs that terrorize communities in the Western Cape and in the south of Johannesburg? This is an incredibly important aspect of your work, because as we all know, throughout history and in many different countries and contexts, one of the best ways to get gangsters is financially, not necessarily on all of their murders and other crimes that they commit, because those are very difficult to prove and get evidence for. But you follow the money and you catch the gangsters. So I'd like to know what work you've done and how many convictions of drug gangsters you have played a role in. Then my last question is for GTAC. We hear often that there is too slow a pipeline of major government infrastructure projects, and that there is a lot of interest and support from the private sector and from the asset management industry to fund big infrastructure projects, but those projects are not coming around. And we see also the, I won't say collapse, but near collapse of the construction industry in South Africa as a result of there just being not enough major infrastructure projects happening. So my question to you is, what work do you do to speed up not just the execution of a project once it has already been agreed on, but also the pipeline of major infrastructure projects, so that at any one time there should always be major infrastructure projects underway somewhere in the country, and there should never be this period now where we have this kind of almost forced recession that the DG and the Minister referred to, because there is just no major infrastructure spending happening anywhere in South Africa at precisely the time when we need it most. So I'd like to get your view on that. And just another very quick question on GTAC. The President has set out his ambition to get us back into the top 50 of the World Bank Ease of Doing Business Competitiveness Report. Precisely the right ambition, and should be fully supported. What work are you doing in that regard to help particularly major metros cut red tape, make it easier to do business, and get us up, moving up those rankings? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. Firstly, to FIC, when I look at the presentation on slide 6, when you also spoke about the sectors involved and who's obligated to implement the PICA, the question is, there's minimum requirements, but a lot of these institutions or sectors will implement PICA on a different way and require different information from clients. So it seems as though there's sometimes the FICA is used as a pretext to obtain certain information. Is that so? Is there any boundary or border set by FICA to actually say you can't ask this and this from a client, this is the minimum requirement or this is the actual requirement? Because the minimum is set, but it seems as though it's actually there's no border with regards to that. Then to GTEC, you mentioned that your work is typically initiated by a request. Who requests that? Is it municipalities, departments, or is it National Treasury? And has it ever happened that a legislature, for instance, has requested, especially with regards to your work in terms of advice on the feasibility of infrastructure, that a legislature would request a report on the feasibility? And in such case, are those reports tabled somewhere? Do they go somewhere? And with regards to those requests, and then just also with regards to your capacity, we are at a stage where we need a lot of infrastructure projects, as my colleague has also mentioned. But do you actually have the capacity to, if you get a huge number of requests from a number of municipalities, most municipalities in the country, most provincial departments do not know how to spend their infrastructure grants at this stage. There's huge underspending in terms thereof. So there is a huge request or a huge demand for that technical advice in that regard. Do you have the capacity if all nine provinces were to request your advice and your services in that regard? And then what qualifies as a high impact government initiative? You use that term, what do you define as that? And then also, there's a lot of projects that take place where the most corruption and the phase of the corruption is in the planning phase. The actual work that you do is contracted to private consultants, which they never actually do the work, or planning takes 7 years or 8 years and costs huge amounts, and the actual project never takes place, especially in terms of infrastructure projects. What do you do to advise and to assist to create an environment in our government departments and public sector where we don't use and we're not exploited by private consultants who uses especially the planning phase in terms, and I know in provincial departments, the school infrastructure projects are the huge challenge with regards to that, where there's audit opinions on that each year because of the fact that planning is not done. Money is spent on planning, but planning is never done, and all of that. Do you have a plan with regards to that? Do you do work in that regard to streamline the planning phases of infrastructure projects, especially on provincial and local level? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. I just want to ask one short question to Vic, which is a second question. When you spoke about your achievements, in particular the cash threshold report, you mentioned that you were, if I heard it correctly, that you were referring to transactions of 25,000 above. If then I'm correct, that means if the transaction is less than that, it doesn't qualify to be a successful transaction If yes, would that not encourage them in some states to deposit less than 25 so that they can't be traced? Thank you.
No, thanks, Honorable Chair. No, I want to acknowledge and appreciate the political input that was given by the Honorable Deputy Minister, and also welcome all the presentations that were made today. On the FIC, yeah, I've heard that you are saying you are a national center that gathers transaction data and provides financial intelligence, and that you are the only entity authorized to receive and analyze suspicious transaction reports. However, as you also indicated, that you don't have a mandate to do investigation. My question, which was partly covered by Honorable Shibambu, is that what do you do with such a report? After you have gathered such an information, what do you do with it? Do you take it to the NPA or to the Hawks? And maybe also to take it further than that, if it happens that your report end up in a court of law as part of the evidence, do you also go to the court of law to defend your report? That's the question. And again, you say that you are giving guidance to financial and non-financial institutions to ensure awareness and compliance. And I think you also made mention, I think in one of the slides, the institutions that you are targeting, as you say, they are institutions that are vulnerable to money laundering, which includes your estate agents, banks, attorneys, gambling sectors, motor vehicle dealers, and forex dealers. And that these institutions, I think they are supposed to report to you, to give some reports to you. When are they reporting to you? Do they have to submit mandatory reports, or do they have to report as and when there's a need to do so? And if you don't get any report from them, what do you do from this institution? And one question to GTEC. I think we are doing a great job by facilitating engagements between departments and other state organs, and also assisting them with spending, project plans, budgeting, and infrastructure finance. But now, as you also indicated, that you only assist as per invitation. So my question would be, what prohibits you from initiating engagement or intervention? What is it that prohibits you? Why do you have to wait for invitation when you see that a certain state organ, they are having a challenge that requires your assistance? What is it that prohibits you to initiate that engagement or assistance? And one question, which is my last question to CBDA. You were established in 2007 under the Cooperative Bank Act number 40 of 2007, which is about 12 years ago. And up to this date, I think you've got you have established only four cooperative banks and about 22 CFIs. After 12 years, what is the challenge? Have you not marketed yourself enough? Because 12 years is a very long time, but the whole country were only having four cooperative banks and about 22 CFIs. What are the challenges? Why are we having such a very low number in terms of this particular cooperative bank? Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
Thanks. Let me make a comment on one matter on procurement, which is provided for in the Constitution, Chapter 30.
DG, you remember in my previous life that there was a challenge of government to government procurement of services. For instance, a country has got a capacity on energy, and it has got a relationship with South Africa. PFMA doesn't provide for the two governments, SA or with Russia or with China or with whosoever, to enter into an agreement whereby a country A can build infrastructure in a country B, which is South Africa. If you look at the international trends currently, because we are complaining that the economy is not growing, there's no infrastructure development, there's no investment. If you look at most of the countries in Africa and beyond, they are beginning to enter into state-to-state or government kind of agreements. You can look at the rail infrastructure between Mombasa and Nairobi. It's an agreement between China and the government of Kenya. It's a massive infrastructure. If you look at what is happening in Djibouti, Djibouti is a very small country up there and very barren. But if you look at the development that's happening right now as a result of the government of Djibouti and Chinese government agreement on the development of a harbor, it's a massive infrastructural development. And you come to South Africa, you want to do the same, then you say no. PFMA does not provide for that. I don't know what to be done in that regard, because small countries in the continent and beyond are surpassing South Africa in terms of infrastructural development, because they are looking at that model of government or state-to-state kind of agreement. And if you remain with this rigid kind of framework at this era, you go nowhere. Look currently what's happening between Russia and China. Russia just entered into an agreement with China, and they now have what a 5G that has been developed by whatever way of China or whatever. And we want to talk about rollout of fourth industrial revolution. How do you roll out with the 3 and 4G when Russia, China, and others are at a very advanced stage? So the procurement regime that we have in South Africa is very prohibitive of development as we talk now in terms of the international or global governance that we have. Unless we do something about it, developments will continue to go into other countries and not come to our shores. So it's a matter that I thought you should look at, because as part of the mandate, because if there's a department that is well outlined in terms of its scope and function, it's finance in chapter 13 of the Constitution as you outlined here. That's a matter that has to be actually looked at. So thanks very much, Honorable Member. Invite the Deputy Minister, the DG, and the heads of different entities to respond to the questions asked by members. Deputy Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Maybe let me start with the last question. I think it's important that we recognize the constitutional construct that we happen to find ourselves in as a country, in the way it was designed. And if you look at the provisions thereof for fair, transparent, you know, all of those things that I mentioned earlier in my opening remarks, then, you know, if you look at them in that context and say then a law that find expression in what the Constitution says then became the PFMA in 1997-98, and then we implemented it, you know, or we then formulated the PFMA and the FMA along those lines, then the reality is that we have to deal with what we have. And after out of that came out various regulations, practice notes, instruction notes, etc. And then we developed in the last couple of years, 25 years until today, and then we find the environment totally different in terms of your point around delivery, speed of delivery, and the PFMA as an inhibiting factor. So there's that context, and if you then find your shoes, you know, in our shoes as treasury, we then have to implement what the law says. When need be, if it's not instructive as such, we then have to obviously apply based on what we think is along the lines, and obviously with all the legal you know, considerations, etc. But then that still in itself is a problem, as people indicate currently. You know, Chair, maybe let me divert and say to you, even now in government, that's a conversation. Actually, interesting enough, as we speak right now, my office is sending a letter to all the DGs, including provincial DGs. I'm saying to them, because this issue is coming over and over again, I'm saying to all the counterparts, I'm saying, here's the PFMA, here's the treasury instructions, the CPO practice notes, everything. And there's an issue out there that says we're inhibiting development, with not getting managers to manage. Indicate areas that you think we should have a relook at, and then let's talk. I basically calling for my colleagues in the government system to say, let's engage on this. Some of them maybe outdated practice notes or instruction notes that we may have to change without breaking any law. In some cases, generally, it will call for us to maybe amend the PFMA, the MFMA, or even a necessity for the Constitution to be relooked at in some areas. I'm not saying we are going to do it, but the reality is that we have to maybe review some of what we used to do or some of what we are used to be doing for the past 25 years. And I think as a state that is developing, we have to continuously do that. And I think with the example that you gave around Djibouti and Mombasa Rail, etc., and around, for instance, our legal, and we got a senior council opinion 2 years ago when we looked at the nuclear process and the whole thing. The issue was that there's no country-to-country provision here. It can only be entity-to-entity, and that entity must then be subject to a process that is above board in terms of transparency, openness, etc., the constitution dictates. If that entity in that particular country gets the tender, then it's a different story, we can move on. So you're right, Chair, I think it's an area that we need to relook at, and I think we cannot leave that out. Now, I thought also, Chair, maybe broadly, let me just explain GTEC, and maybe they'll come in later. GTEC can only, as indicated, act on request. But we should not confuse GTEC as the treasury in that. The treasury is the one that engages in municipalities. The treasury that you, and based on that, in some cases, there might be a need for us as treasury or for an ex-municipality to request specialized services from GTEC. In that case, finally, then the MOU is written, and then services provided, and then a report or assistance is granted by GTEC. If you look at the infrastructure fund, as a classic example, infrastructure space, government realized and noticed that infrastructure spend is a challenge. Huge amounts of money remains underspent in some areas when clearly there's a need out there, and we know infrastructure is a catalyst to boost the economy and to grow the economy. That we know. It is for that reason, Chair, that 2 years ago, 3 years ago actually, we came up with something called the BFI process. It was all in the budget review and budget documents past 2 years, where we established a budget facility for infrastructure. What we simply were doing with that was that we recognized that many a project remain, of which the project preparation is a problem in South Africa. The ability to put projects together, to appraise projects, to do feasibility studies is a problem. As an example, in a we then called for departments to submit, and we called them BFI projects, like your big infrastructure build program, big one. Then, the first round, for instance, after 43 projects were submitted to Treasury, only one project in the first year got all the ticks. When I say all the ticks, it means the feasibility study was there, EIA there, there's value for money, and all of those things that, who does the appraisal, the team of GPSA, CSIR experts, and experts in the Treasury. The whole reason was to build a pipeline for infrastructure projects to be funded. 18 months later, meaning a year, almost a year ago, we announced, the president announced an infrastructure fund, which essentially we say we can leverage public sector money and get more private sector participants to come in, DFIs, private lenders, anyone to come in and play a role in the infrastructure space. Now, with the maturity of the DFI process, as more projects are presented, appraisal is more intense, projects then start graduating from bad projects to projects that we can fund, that private sector can come in. So it's an ongoing process. No, it's not GTEC. For instance, GTEC will be part. Some experts in the capital project unit in the GTEC would be part of the appraisal team that we have put together as part of ensuring that we create a strong project pipeline that will really boost infrastructure. So I thought, let me explain that, because it is also important, and the FIC can talk about lifestyle audit. But what we have done is actually a project that DPSA is leading, and that we support fully, that lifestyle audit should be performed across the public service, and between the Public Service Commission and the DPSA, one expects that a framework should be developed, and once it's developed, then if the expertise of SARS is needed, the expertise of FIC is needed, and any other, that can be done. But it's something that I think we have supported, and we say it should be done as soon as possible. Now, the CBDA, Honorable Siyomba, I agree. I mean, look, we need to relook at the design, we need to have the impact that the CBDA offers, and I think I'm just noting that, and I think we must revert back into approaching the CBA, how to make it effective, how to actually make sure that it's redesigned, that it fits the purpose, and colleagues can always talk more about the work that they want to do and the work that they do. In terms of, again, the job fund performance, we this issue is a very interesting area of focus for the Appropriations Committee. I think we go every 3 months or so, we go to the Appropriations Committee, we report in our annual report in terms of the job fund performance vis-a-vis the original $9.9 billion that was set, and there's adequate report provided. But I think if the Standing Committee of Finance would like us to actually, you know, detect an outcome, we're more than happy to report on the performance of the jobs fund, of the jobs fund person. Now, in terms of Program 3 and Program 7, Program 3 around intergovernmental relations, yes, I think municipalities remain important, and municipalities by nature are, I mean, 250 plus municipalities, degree levels, varying degree levels of expertise and experience, and also the boundaries and the demarcation board having played a role, and all of that, you know, and we all know it was a consultative process. But what is important is that we view municipalities separately. We are responsible, for instance, for 17 non-delegated municipalities as national treasurer, including the 8 metros. And provincial treasurers also have got a huge role that they play in non-delegated municipalities, where, in other municipalities, including smaller municipalities. So the reach that we have is, one can say, obviously not adequate because of human capacity within the treasury, but we've divided that across provincial treasuries. We've also strengthened the capacity in provincial treasuries to have specific local government units that focus on municipalities. So again, there are about 4 or 5 programs that we run. The Municipal Finance Improvement Program at National Treasury. We have benchmark, budget benchmark exercises where in some cases we call municipalities to come to us to engage with us, because before they table their budget, to ensure that what they do, there is that process of the Ministry of Foreign Chart of Accounts that makes it easy also for us to understand what's happening in municipalities and the spending thereof. So clearly the results of what's happening in these municipalities are mixed, and the impact of these programs broadly. And we obviously, the issues of high staff turnover, they've got political challenges on the ground, and all the challenges that the Auditor General sometimes raises in his report around challenges faced by municipalities. We're also not doing this alone. If we can't do it alone, we will mess it up. We have constant engagements and collaborations with COCTA and also with SAUDA to actually make interventions clear and known. But the reality is that the challenges is not enough. Now, what about smaller ones where the revenue base is weak? Again, we can only build on the Division of Revenue Act that Parliament passed at the end. We can only allocate as per that. And then the issue then becomes, what about smaller ones whose revenue base is low, who are only dependent on conditional grants, who are only, the revenue base from rates and taxes is not enough, what do we do? It becomes a big issue and a challenge, because as you know, only less than 10%, almost around 10 or 11% of national budget is going to, from a division of revenue point of view, to municipalities. So yeah, it will always be an issue and a challenge. Now, around civil and military pensions, Program 7 is performing very well. If you look at last year's report, then all I can talk about is what happened, the actual, because you can only pick it up later, when they reached almost 95% of payment rates, because the program itself is not managed directly by us, but obviously with the assistance of DIPA. So, but as per the annual report and what we indicated to Parliament, the program is performing very well. The last point about entities that are responsible for national, there are 16 entities and not 17. 17 because there was South African Airways, which then went back to public enterprises. So we remain with 16. But I think one of Shivambo's points is much broader than just the numbers. I understand it has got to do with those that are established in law, those that are proclaimed, those that are, and we obviously need to look at, and the point, I think, and from a governance point of view, I think maybe we need to re-look at that around those that are not established in terms of an act of parliament. Maybe then we can clear the whole governance arrangement, and the key example is around SARS, because if you look at SARS, for instance, and we can talk more when SARS in terms of accountability mechanisms built in and the confusion that sometimes is there. You want to have an overarching role, and the Nugent Commission, and again SARS can talk to it, the Nugent Commission is very clear in terms of proposals that should be taken forward or through as part of a reforming some of the governance arrangements at SARS. And I think we need to take that into account. Jim, I don't think if I've left anything, you can.
No, I think DG has covered almost everything. I think the issue that the chair has raised regarding procurement, my proposal, Chair, would be that let's look at the public procurement bill, which is now in the cabinet system, as the DG has said, and see what are the transformative possibilities it presents, of course, within the context of the Constitution. So that is my proposal, that in the context of this public procurement bill, it provides us with a huge opportunity to rethink how we're doing procurement. And I think the issue around the lifestyle audit, not only FIC can be an enabler in helping us to conduct the lifestyle audit in government, but that has to be within the framework that government is working on. So once that framework is tabled, I think we need to look at it and see whether all relevant institutions that can play an enabling role, enforcement role, insofar as the lifestyle audit is concerned. And the point about the governance of some of the entities that report to us, including SARS, I think DG has definitely covered that. But at the risk of repeating myself, I think the public procurement bill provides us with a huge opportunity to rip and cow with your procurement. I think Honourable Shrambu may have to clarify what does he mean by powers invested in a position, a DDG responsible for the finance, policy and tax matters. Because I'm not certain what exactly it's meant by powers invested in that office, because I'm sure it's not about the individual. It could be the way we have designed the our own internal institutional arrangement. There could be problems there. So I think we just need to get guidance on what exactly is meant by the powers concentrated in that office. And so that if there's any problems, we can look at that, as opposed to looking at the individual moment.
Chair, let me respond. I think on a broader level, I must agree that indeed the sector is still at a very low base in terms of the cooperative bank and the organizations and institutions. It's very at a low base. You will recall South Africa during the apartheid had huge cooperative banks which were demutualized, and some of them are now within the APSA institutions. So there is a history in the country of very strong cooperative banks. But the potential within the broader South African society is huge for cooperative banks to be established and to thrive. For example, if just I could give you a case, we've got Stockfels that have 11.4 million members, whose current revenue generation is in the vicinity of 44 billion. But there are little benefits that are accrued to those members in real economic terms. And the cooperative banks offer an opportunity for that realization in terms of mainstreaming that community within the fraternity of the financial banking system. So this is the opportunity that is there. But for it to be realized, there has to be some legislative changes that accommodate these financial instruments that are sitting among our people within the Cooperative Banks Act. There are certain particular, we've outlined those constraints that are sitting there, members, that needs to be unlocked so that we can then recruit this big capital base within the cooperative bank system. Secondly, the other issue is that there lies a high potential to really elevate the levels of inequalities and improve them in South Africa. So this instrument must not in any manner be underestimated, its potential that rests within it to be able to bring the high marginalized society within the banking a sector of the economy. Most countries in the world that are leading in the financial sector, cooperatives are in the front line of that. Cooperative banks are in the front line. In the United States of America, they are running into trillions of dollars. And even also in European countries are running into serious billions of dollars, cooperatives, banks that are leading in the financial institutions. So in South Africa, it's which I think a lot of changes needs to happen. In terms of the issue of, there are challenges within CBDA. even its budget is very minuscule. Remember, we're sitting at the 20 million as the budget that is available. You can't do much with that money. It's very limited in practical effort. 60 million of that money goes into payment of staff, and then only 4 million is available for any particular activities that needs to be done. That's very limited in its scope. So these are the kinds of challenges that are available there. The other challenges that we need to deal with are around the sector itself. There is a high level of skilling of our people, where cooperatives are, even the current ones that are existing, are not using the principle of economies of scale. Cooperatives are institutions of numbers. You want to ensure the high critical capital base, you improve your members. You increase. The more members you have, the more the capital base is there within the cooperatives. That is a matter of skilling our people and educating them so that they can understand that and recruit all the members within the cooperative sector. That is one of the issues that are there. We are already, I think we alluded earlier, that there is a strategy underway that is charting the future, and we're hoping that that strategy, which will be presented here in the House, will be looked at critically. But I will hate a situation whereby we will throw a baby with the bath water and then say that this is an institution that is not relevant. In fact, its relevance is much more than one who could realize. It's just that we need to have a will to support it and strengthen it and enable it to realize the value that is not yet unlocked in South Africa. So the other issue that I'll just say is that with respect to advocacy, there is a need of advocacy that we need to undertake even within the community that I talked about, who are sitting with us with a value to the vicinity of 44 billion. You can't do that with the funds that we have at our disposal. We need huge funds, a huge vehicle that will take place at the multiple levels to mobilize those kinds of support. I think there are other issues that have been raised, have been dealt with. I wouldn't like to really go in depth on it, just to say that we believe that this institution is relevant in terms of the growth of it. The numbers speak for themselves. They are very low, and in fact, if you look at the trend, we've seen a decline from 23 of CFI to 22. So they are growing down, because of the fact that the levels of skill and capitalization within those institutions is also an issue that needs to be looked at, because some of them are suffering with limited capitalization. So, and then also with the education to recruit members to strengthen that capitalization as well, which also we as government must also look critically and say, how do we then support that institution, because it's at infancy. It has to contend and compete with highly advanced commercial banks in South Africa. And so in that regard, it's not going to be an easy road. It's going to be fraught with a lot of difficulties and challenges, but I think it needs a critical will. At some point, we are going to come back to give a detailed perspective once the strategy is in of how we want to revive the sector. Thank you very much.
No, thanks, Chair. I will try to handle some of the questions that came from the members of the committee. And the most complex questions will be responded to by Peter Smith, my colleague here. But at the same time, I just want to indicate that some of the questions obviously are interlinked. So we are not necessarily going to be doing a direct blow-by-blow. But just contextual flow. It is indeed, honourable member, as the FIC, we deal with very sensitive information. And one thing that you have done, obviously, as the legislators, which we appreciate, is that you have defined each and every element of our work in law. So we are not doing anything outside the Financial Intelligence Center Act. Practically, every step we take, we are able to quote a section in the Act that defines that. Now, We are basically, I'm basically starting by indicating indeed we deal with confidential information. Therefore, Section 40, Subsection 3, then defines how our information needs to be handled by the recipients of the information. And in the context of that legislative provision, we then have what we call, in terms of the recipient entities, a sanctioning officer vis-a-vis an authorized officer. Meaning, if we are to talk the Hawks as an example, the Hawks have to appoint somebody on their side to be a sanctioning officer, meaning somebody who is going to be overseeing the receipt of our information by various authorized officers within the DPCI space. So in that context, each of those authorized officers has to undergo a training that we provide as the FIC in making sure that we literally orientate them on how to handle our information. And we then also do a month-to-month update of that database because we don't even want to send our information on somebody who is no longer supposed to be receiving our information, just on the basis of the sensitivity that goes with it. So I thought I just needed to basically just touch on that. And then the second question, as reflected on, is just the point you referred to. In our efforts to handle money laundering, what kind of capacity do we have once the money has exited the country? So Peter has spoke about the fact that we are a member of what is called the Egmont Group of Financial Intelligence Centers globally. So in that context, up to this point, we have signed over 90 memorandum of understanding with FIUs in the global theater. And currently we talk about 165 of those that are members of the Egmont Group, which we are a member too. So on that basis, once money moves from South Africa into any jurisdiction, within the context through which we have an MOU with, we are then able to interface with that stakeholder in that jurisdiction to be able to follow the money in that jurisdiction to its ultimate destination. And of course, in cases where that money has to be repatriated, we then activate the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, as you will know, to make sure that we then activate the mutual legal assistance, and then that process gets followed, and obviously the money gets repatriated. And of course, in certain cases, money do enter jurisdictions that we don't have a memorandum of understanding with. So even in that case, we do engage with those jurisdictions, and those that are more compliant in a way facilitate us to be able to get all that back. However, those that are members to Egmont, there is that understanding and agreement in such a way that should any role player on the other side not comply, we are then able to, in a way, report them to the Egmont Group, and out of that we are able to get that aspect dealt with. The third element that you referred to is who then receives a completed financial intelligence report, and then ultimately how do we make follow-up. So the first point that I want to indicate on that, as I've indicated, in case of a reactive financial intelligence report, the receiver becomes the requester. The one who has requested it will then be sending it back to that requester. But by the way, no request, and I'm talking here in the context of law enforcement, or even other role players who do administrative, SIU, public protector, and the rest, no one can request information if it's not an authorized officer. So it's not about somebody writing to us wanting information from the FIC. That requester has to be the authorized officer. So it will go to the requester, and then obviously it gets administrated on the other side. In terms of the proactive financial intelligence report, again, that particular financial intelligence report, once prepared, the content of it will then define the recipient. For instance, if in the proactive financial intelligence report we are working on, we pick up tax evasion as an issue that has unfolded, then the receiver becomes the African Revenue Services. Once we pick up corrupt tendency or corruption-related activities, it then goes to the Hawks. Ultimately, it could be handled by what we call the anti-corruption task team. If the issue is, for instance, related to doing the process that administratively must be retrieved back to the state, then we engage with the asset forfeiture unit within the National Prosecuting Authority, and we work together to make sure that money gets frozen and ultimately the money gets taken back into the state. So effectively, as it were, in terms of the feedback mechanism, we have built up a feedback mechanism which is electronic at all times. Meaning, once we've given out a report, each and every quarter, we expect the receiver to send us an update to indicate where are they in as far as the report is given. But one thing to note is the fact that it's not each report per case. One report, more than one report from our side can actually serve one case in the law enforcement side, meaning the case as registered by the police services can actually in itself have more than one financial intelligence report. So therefore, the feedback is not necessarily a task-based feedback report, as it were. So that is just for the purposes of responding to that. And of course, the rest of the other questions then that I will talk to. Then I go over to the issue about we are not an intelligence agency, and therefore, how do we collect information? And by the way, this might be a conceptual issue in terms of the word intelligence. But what we basically mean by the fact that we are not an intelligence agency, we mean we do not apply the trade craft of intelligence, meaning we don't do surveillance on people, we don't necessarily, you know, follow through on people. Lack of a better word, we don't do conventional spying on people. SSA does that. Crime intelligence does that. Now, from our side, unfortunately, globally, the word intelligence ended up being used. Hence, other countries said, we can't use the word intelligence. They call their FIC, Financial Enforcement Center, for example, and all of that, trying to move away from the concept. But basically, that is basically the meaning in as far as that whole issue is concerned. Now, the issue that you're asking, and of course you are very aware of what you're talking to. By the way, remember the context of our work. A bank, when they look into financial activity of their client, they pick up a suspicion. And let that be practical, because we don't want to be academic on these issues. If we are talking to, or we're talking about you as a parliamentary employee, your bank is able to pick up your monthly salary as usual. They can pick it up this month on the 30th, that month on the 30th, and this is the figure. But all of a sudden, in the middle of the month, there is 2 million dropped into your bank account. And that 2 million is dropped as cash, for instance. And when they try to understand who dropped that cash is reference Philip, which basically could be anything. So that on its own then presents a suspicion. Where does this 2 million come from? So it is on the basis of that that the bank then sends that to us. So what we need to be doing on our side, we have to then do work on the basis of that suspicious transaction and try to use other databases and be able to look at yourself as an individual to check where probably this money is coming from. Once we cannot get a real answer as to where it comes from, then we basically, on the basis of that suspicion, then develop a financial intelligence report, which we then give to law enforcement for them to look at. However, law enforcement now, because they operate different from us, they then have then the right to do other things which we can't do. One of that is to actually engage you on the issue. Once they pick up a real explanation of that particular amount, therefore, our report therefore ends there. And that is why you will find that sometimes we send something on the other side, they say that particular report has been closed. It's on the basis of them having done further work which we couldn't have been able to cover, based on our legislative mandate, as it were. Now, the issue raised by the honorable member about the scorecard, by the way, we do agree with the input, you know, that you're providing, but we just want to indicate that as we meet twice annually as financial intelligence centers globally, we share experiences, we share practices, we look into how each one of us is effectively advancing the whole issue of anti-money laundering and para-financing regime, as it were. And these are some of the places where we learn some of these issues. But we do agree with your point, because we say the scorecard itself is a live document, meaning we can always improve it as we go along. So we are currently using a 3-point scale, it's 1 until 3, and we add that up to be able to determine high priority, medium, or lower. And of course, your point on the basis of the tips, as it were, politically influential person, you're suggesting that maybe we need to move that to a 4. So let me agree that we will then look into that as we do continuous updating, we will then be able to indicate, because that is indeed very, very true. Just a quick one on the success rate. And by the way, one thing that I just need to confirm, Chair, so that we are at least at one stage. One of the reasons why FIC is not necessarily that much in the public space is because the kind of work that we do, if we become too much in the public space, we will be defeating the rationale of our existence. Because if we become in the public and we literally explain the kind of operational mechanisms that we use, people will literally be pissed about what we do, and they will literally just subvert the system, as it were. And that is, I would say, one of the reasons why. But I can give you practical examples on the question you're asking about the whole issue of narcotics fellows, the whole issue of the gangsters and all of that. Practically, without necessarily wanting to sound like anything, when you hear of any success that is associated with the hawks, you must know, from a financial intelligence point of view, the FIC was fully behind that. But we can't explain it. And this is the typical example. If you remember that few, and this I'm talking about it because it's just something that you're able to associate with, we used to have a very serious problem called cash in transit in the country. Now, the people who are not necessarily understanding the system, they go out there, they do cash in transit, and they take the cash, they drop it into the formal system. So basically, when they do that, then they get into our books, and we are able to then get them paid. But at the same time, we have also picked up that there are some who know the system, they pick up the cash in cash in transit, but they don't put it in the system, but they go use it. That is why, in the past few years, we established what we call Open Source Intelligence Center. That is an entity within ourselves. Its responsibility is to literally vacuum clean everything in the social space to be able to pick up anomalies. And in that context, we are able to pick up some of those, you know, cash in transit fellows who then splash out what they actually stole in the media, in the social media. And that actually serves as a trigger to put that in the system and be able to activate that. The last example I want to give you, which is a very sensitive example, but I have to be given it because it's a basic sensitive example, is that once you are on a wanted list by the hawks, as an example, practically they might not know where you are. But on the basis of the work that we do, we then actually engage with the patient community to say this particular person is effectively in the radar, is basically a wanted fellow, as it were. Now, the point is, once you do any financial transaction, that on its own activates us and we activate the hawk. And I think you know what that means. Whether it's about your app on your phone, you must then know that you will actually be activated. Whether it's using your card on your way to Bergen on N4 or N3, whatever the case is, then you must know that we get activated. And then that is how you will hear the hawks have busted the wanted fellow on whatever road. So I'm just saying, those are some of the things that you can't easily go and talk to, because that will then defeat the purpose. I'm just giving you the example on the basis of the question asked, and also on the basis of, we just don't want to be out there indicating this on the basis of us. But because we are accounting to you, just give you those snippets so that we are at least at the same page. Let me then conclude by touching on the issue of, I think Peter will touch on the issue of the FCR. When the issue is only authorized, we do not investigate, what do you, the report. By the way, as I've indicated, if we give a report and the work does not, or that the work terminates it, we need an explanation for that termination. And once that explanation is provided, then we are able to get everything sorted. Yeah, let me stop here, and then Peter will address most of the other questions. I hope we tried to explain that. Thanks.
Thank you very much. So firstly, on the question on public awareness, the FIC has not previously done a lot of work on raising general public awareness around the money laundering system, the legislation, etc. Our focus and our efforts have been much more on the specific guidance to the institutions that have to comply with the FIC Act, it's mainly the financial institutions, and explaining to them what our expectations are of a bank, for instance, if they have to identify customers and report transactions to the FIC and so forth. We have recognized this as an issue that requires attention from the FIC's part, and I think partly because of the point that Mike had just made, that our work is often done in conjunction with other authorities. That general public awareness actually requires a combined effort between ourselves and institutions like the orgs, etc. So that is something that we are discussing, and we have put in place the feedback mechanisms for them to start giving us better feedback on what the information, the use of their information is with what we provide to them. But the next step of that would then be how we provide more general public awareness communication on the back of that. The question on pension funds, pension funds are not currently one of the types of entities that are subject to compliance obligations under the FIC Act as an entity in and of itself. And we have in the past considered this, but not necessarily seen a big enough risk of money being laundered to a pension fund through the use of the pension fund itself as a means to launder money so that we can justify including that under the scope of the FIC Act. However, the fund manager who invests money for a pension fund is an accountable institution under the FIC Act and must comply with our FIC Act obligations because they actually manage the facilitation of and the movement of funds, etc. And we consider them to be a more vulnerable sector that has to comply with these obligations under the FIC Act. capacity for the FIC to deal with whether we focus on dealing with individuals or entities in general, that I think the answer to that depends on what part of the legal framework it is that we're focusing on. If we're looking at somebody that's committed money laundering, we would there work with the investigating agencies, and we would actually be trying to find the individual that was involved in the money laundering. And what we often find is that such an individual might have worked through a company that they set up and used the company to open a bank account and funnel the illicit proceeds through that company's account. So we would try to trace through that and actually find the individual. We call it the warm body with the arms and legs that sits behind the scheme. Where we talk about the compliance with the requirements of the FIC Act, there we would more look at the entity itself, so the bank, whether the bank has done the right things and asked the right questions and obtained the right information. And if we find that they haven't, we would then work with the supervisor to sanction the bank, the institution itself. The question about stock sales, this was asked in the context of the cash transaction report, and as Mike had said, currently the threshold where institutions have to, that triggers a report where cash is used is 25,000 rand. So any amount of 25,000 rand and up is reported to the FIC. We have recognized that this amount is as economy is changing and people's financial activity is changing, we might have to reconsider this actual amount. And there's a discussion with between the FIC and National Treasury and the Minister at the moment. The Minister has actually published regulations for comment in the beginning of the year to increase this amount to 50,000. So that is something that we're looking at for the future. But having said that, the FIC does not track stock sales specifically. The institutions that have to make these reports are those that actually hold the business facility with a customer where such a transaction happens. So let's, for instance, say a stock sale has a bank account in which the money is deposited. The bank will have an obligation to report the 25,000 or 50,000 in future threshold transactions. We don't consider the threshold transaction to be suspicious in and of itself. We get millions and millions. I think in our last slide we said more than 4 million of those transactions were reported to us in the previous financial year. So we can't possibly look at each one of those and see whether there's something suspicious about a deposit of cash. We will use that information in conjunction with the other information that's reported to us on transactions that have been identified as possibly suspicious and so forth before we actually start making use of that information. This also touches slightly on the discussion from the CBDA on the establishment of cooperative banks, and this is something that we also need to consider in future, whether cooperative banks would have a similar reporting obligation. But a cooperative bank's mechanism of operation is very different from a normal retail bank, so we will have to understand how the compliance obligations would fit in there. Which brings us to what is expected of a bank when they deal with a customer, especially where they pick up suspicious transaction activity. The reason why a transaction would be identified as suspicious is something that happens in that institution, let's say in the bank, in which they have seen, and Mike has given an example, for instance, where a person's income pattern changes suddenly or becomes irregular. There may be a number of other reasons. We don't tell an institution when we think that a transaction is suspicious. The institution must become genuinely suspicious, and then that triggers the obligation for them to report the information to the FIC. The institution has no authority under the FIC Act to do anything about the transaction that they report to the FIC. They cannot stop that transaction on their own. Only the FIC can intervene and go and tell the institution, we think there's a real risk of this money disappearing out of the country, for instance, and then we will instruct the institution to freeze that account or to stop that transaction, for instance. But the institution itself has no authority under the FIC Act to do anything about the transaction that they report to the FIC. They can't interrogate the customer. We actually advise institutions not to do that because that might tip off the person on whom the report is made that something. Somebody is now aware of something suspicious that they're busy with, and they may run with the money. What does happen, though, in what we have seen with especially the larger banks, is that where there's a repetitive pattern of suspicious behavior on a particular customer's profile or history, the bank will then say, well, we do not want this customer anymore. And then they will say, well, we close your account, please take your business elsewhere. For us, that's not necessarily a good outcome from the way that the system operates, because once a customer leaves the banking system, we have no way of seeing what's going on from the FIC's point of view. We have a very selfish reason why we want banks to keep customers within the system so that they can generate the information that helps us do our work. But unfortunately, that's a business decision that every institution is free to take based on their own consideration. That's not something we are able to interfere with, but although we try to influence the decision in the institutions rather towards maintaining customer relationships instead of exiting customers that they consider to be of high risk. The lifestyle audits, I think the DG and the Deputy Minister has already touched on that. The FIC definitely has a role to play in the process of conducting lifestyle audits, and especially as a processing unit for the receipt of information that's generated through a lifestyle audit process and indicating where red flags may need to be raised. Although the FIC within the current legislative mandate cannot actually perform lifestyle audits, legal mandate doesn't allow us to do that. So whether the legislation requires an amendment to expand the scope of the FIC's authority and the legislative mandate of the FIC, that's a policy question I think that needs to be taken at a different level. Although we would say that does take the focus of the FIC away from the normal combating of crime, which was the original basis for the creation of the FIC, into a different direction. And the real challenging part with lifestyle audits is that they are intrusive and they do affect people's private information or confidential information which would otherwise not have been subject to scrutiny. So there is a level of a trade-off that the person then needs to be aware of if they assume a certain public function, that they will then give up certain confidentiality or privacy rights that affect or that are available to all citizens. So in that context, I think one then also needs to understand what role the FIC can play in supporting a lifestyle audit process, where there is definitely a role for the FIC there, although I don't think the FIC would be the lead organization to actually conduct and manage the whole system of a lifestyle audit process. question on the... Excuse me, the different ways in which institutions implement the FIC Act, that is very true. And in fact, we've in the last amendments that went through Parliament in 2017 on the FIC Act, there was actually a significant change in the way that the FIC Act obligations affect private sector institutions that have to comply with them. A very deliberate move away from a rules-based approach to a risk-based approach, where the institution needs to decide what level of risk a particular customer poses to that institution to launder money or to abuse the facilities or the services of that institution for a criminal purpose, and on that basis decide what questions and what information they would require from that potential customer. The FRC doesn't set a limit to how far an institution needs to go. We tell the institution you need to go as far as you believe is necessary for you to understand what the risk is that you want to manage with your particular customer. So a normal individual with a salary earner who has a stable profile, etc., would require less scrutiny and less information, for instance, compared to a person in the import-export business that runs a large business that moves money across borders and with various jurisdictions around the world. And those factors would determine what information the institution needs. We have been aware in the past that institutions have used the fact that the FIC Act requires them to obtain information from customers as an excuse to ask for more information than what they really need just to comply with the FIC Act. That has happened. Many times that is so that the institution understands what other business they can market to the customer. When we come across that, we do point out to that such an institution, and especially then also if that has happened in the banking sector, engage with the banking supervisor on that, not publicly, but individually and directly, bilaterally with that institution. We can't tell an institution not to ask those questions, but we can tell them don't quote the FIC or the FIC Act as your justification. Be honest with your customer and tell them you want this information for a different purpose. Because it comes back to the public awareness question. The more that institutions abuse the FIC Act or the fact that they have to comply with the FIC Act to elicit information, the more resistance they build up with their customers to actually provide information which is useful when we require that information. So that's the message that we try to get across to the institution. There was a question on the 25,000 threshold and whether that encourages transactions to be split up, be transacted below the 25,000 threshold. It's possible that it happens, although the FIC Act, where it contains the obligation for institutions to report suspicious transactions, there's a specific subsection in there, in section 29, that says the institution must consider whether a transaction is suspicious because the person is trying to avoid the threshold reporting obligation in the other sections of the Act. So where a bank, for instance, sees that a person is breaking up a large transaction into smaller amounts to avoid the 25,000 threshold, that in itself must be considered to be suspicious, and the institution would have an obligation to report that as a suspicious transaction. As I said before, we don't necessarily consider the threshold transactions themselves to be suspicious transactions. Those are just information about cash movement, which adds to our information base that we use. There was also the question on whether the FIC in the further downstream work on our information would go to the extent of appearing in court and defend our findings and our reporting in court proceedings. Yes, we would. Where that is required by a prosecutor, for instance, to prove a certain fact in a criminal proceeding, we would could be subpoenaed as a witness to that criminal proceeding, and we would then testify as a witness. We have no special authority or dispensation where we can refuse to be part of a legal proceeding where there's a legal process that follows. Normally, when we engage with investigating and prosecuting authorities, we try to explain to them that it's not necessary for them to do that because they have all the information they require when they follow the investigative process and subpoena the bank records or get witness statements from individuals, etc., which makes it unnecessary for them to rely on the FIC's information that we provide to enrich the investigation process. If we do testify in a court, we would probably be called upon to testify on our conclusions or analysis of a particular financial flow, almost in the sense that a forensic auditor or an accountant would do. And in that sense, we would then be testifying before the court as an expert witness. There was also, I think, might have dealt with, but there were a few questions on what would we do if there is no follow-up on information that we have passed on to an investigator. And this is unfortunately a situation where the FIC Act does not give the FIC the authority to dictate how our information must be used or should not be used by those that receive it from us. So we can't tell the DPCR, you must investigate this case when we refer information to them. But through bodies such as the different committees in Parliament and elsewhere, where the different entities are being held to account for how we discharge our obligations, so there is also this requirement for the joint accountability between the FIC and those other institutions that receive information from us, and that's also why we've tried or place a lot of emphasis on getting feedback from our recipients of information to tell us what are they doing with the information that we receive. That in itself helps us to enrich our information, because if we know that the DPCI is investigating and they found other information which they can feedback to us, we will add that to the information base that we have that makes us better at future analysis of transactions on the same people. I think that covers almost
Just the final one, Chair. Honorable Shibambu asked the question about how many cases have we referred to law enforcement, for instance. Our annual report will be coming out very soon. But just to respond to that question, in the past financial year, we have referred around 1,775 both proactive and reactive financial intelligence reports to the various stakeholders. And out of that, over 1,000 had went into the Hawks, because it's the primary consumer of our product. And then that is in terms of the request. In terms of the proactive, we have received 800 of those, and around 500 of those had went into the Hawks. So just in the past quarter of this current financial year, for instance, we have received around 6 high priority financial intelligence reports to the various stakeholders, and 4 of those went into the Hawks, and then we have also referred 300 in terms of the request that we have received just in the past financial year. So this is what we basically track, and you'll see most of this information then gets accounted for in our annual report. Thanks, Chair.
In 2017, there were
No, I was giving you 2018, 2019.
You don't have 2017 numbers. I'm sure towards December there were a lot of
problems. You was off your own members.
And when they find them,
Thank you, Chair. The DG has touched on some of the questions that we also asked of GTEC. I think mainly the job fund, so I won't deal with those ones, and some of them on infrastructure, and I'll just add without repeating repeating what he has said. There was a question on how we enhance the private sector investment in infrastructure that was asked earlier on. And just to say that there are published guidelines on public-private partnerships. National Treasury published these guidelines some time ago, and it's very clear that the role of the National Treasury on these kind of investments is that of a regulator, and GTEC's role then becomes advisory and technical support to organs of state. So these may need to be updated. I think there are processes or talk of updating these to just ensure that we respond to the current economic conditions, because not everything can be financed through the state.
And then the question around the rationalization of schools in the Eastern Cape, that project is a project of the Eastern Cape Department of Education, I think with the Office of the Premier. And it's really meant to be looking at all the, if you remember there was a time when there was this project, it was the ACIDI, it was the acceleration of infrastructure, of school infrastructure, of schools. And now what you have with the distances between the villages, you find some schools are under occupied, others are oversubscribed. And that project is mainly to just take stock of what's in there and give recommendations on which schools could close, which schools could be subsidized, and which schools could be turned into boarding schools, just to make sure that it deals with that. I think that project has just come to an end now. I don't have the report here, but I think we have given a final draft or probably a pre-final draft to the clients in this case. Empowerment of communities, our mandate is to build the state capability. So we work directly with departments. So if departments need their capacity to be built in order to ensure that communities are empowered, it would be indirect. Our role would be indirect in that sense. But we work directly with departments. So the two will talk to the winter school spin-off. The question around infrastructure, assisting municipalities with spending of their infrastructure grants. Where we are now at the moment is in Limpopo, as I said in my presentation. We are assisting the Limpopo Treasury to basically build the capacity of the departments there to spend, the capacity of the municipalities to spend on infrastructure grants. We haven't done this in other provinces. And I must say, this is a spin-off of a program that GTEC ran for the National Treasury on IDEP, the Infrastructure Delivery Improvement Program that was there for, I think it went around 3 or 4 iterations. And this one, first spinning off from the Limpopo, Limpopo Treasury asked GTEC to assist. And even there, we are not involved in infrastructure, in actual delivery of infrastructure, but we are involved in the processes or the management processes that enable that, because eventually what you find is that it's not the lack of capacity to contract private sector to build or to put infrastructure in place, it's more the management processes that lead to that. So we're involved in that. The DG talked about the issue around the pipeline and the BFI, and just to say that our role there is just to support National Treasury in its role in terms of assessing that assessing the projects that are bankable or that can be financed by the state. The other role players there, the other key role players were the PICC as well as the DBSA, and I think now the Department of Public Works. Secretary will also take the issue of the question on ease of doing business in the state in terms of our role there. There was a question around the request. Can the legislation request GTEC to do work? We work directly with departments. I mean, very few times we've worked with the elected officials. And I do think that the role of building infrastructure wouldn't necessarily be a legislative role. It could be a role which would be assigned to a particular department who should then come to GTEC to ask for assistance in that regard. And I'm not sure if I misunderstood the question, but we'll pick it up later. The capacity, what is our capacity to do that? I must also mention that our business model is a different one in that we work with officials. I mean, obviously we do our work through officials, but also a unique feature in our business model is that we run a panel of service providers that we are able to engage quite quickly depending on the need. I cannot promise that if requests came from all 9 provinces to assist, we'd be able to respond as quickly. But what it does is that it gives us the agility with which we can respond to request depending on what it is. So we are busy refreshing our panel at the moment to just make sure that as the skills are required, we are able to respond as quickly as possible but it's a combination. It's quite it's a hybrid model of combining officials, capacity expertise of the officials, plus the expertise of the private sector through a panel of service providers that we manage. The DG spoke about the high impact government projects on infrastructure. I mean, those are the ones that go through this DFI process. And I've spoken to that already. Why can't we take the proactive in assisting? We don't have the mandate to intervene. Our legal notice, the way, or our founding notice, the way it's written, is that we are demand-driven, we respond, but we are also recognizing that it cannot just be that we are trying to now find out ways of how we can be proactive, but without obviously stepping onto the mandate of departments. Departments need to recognize that they need the assistance, so they can, I think, appreciate it more. I think those are the questions that I am answering in addition to how the DG responded. I'll leave the other two to Sweden.
Thanks, Cindy. So the question on, I just wanted to add a point to the last point that Lindy talked about, which is that we are demand-driven. Our legislation does make allowance for an advisory committee, a kind of government oversight. And I think one of the ways we want to interpret the way that the departments can access our support, or for us to act a little bit more proactively, will be to have the guidance of this advisory committee. The entire budget cluster from the National Treasury forms part of that, and it's very clearly defined in our legislation. So it is a way that we can move forward on that. On the winter school, the question had to do with impact and whether we work with higher education and training on it. This is one of those projects that higher education and training and any other related department that might be interested in the initiative is drawn in. So the purpose is really looking at youth, targeted youth employment or basic package of support for youth. The winter school becomes a key way of exposing young economists from universities across the country to the challenges of public policy decision making. And the intention of the program is to get them engaged and interested in working in some way or form in the public sector, even if for a short period of internship. So, you know, the broad area of those who are not in employment or education or training, GTAC's role in the winter school is very much about how do we expand strong economic economists and their intentions to work in the public sector or to work in provinces and to work nationally. So the initiative runs very much like that. And we are in discussion with the presidency now to find ways of expanding this program and getting the attention on youth development and support. So that's with the winter school. The ease of doing business support from the World Bank is a program that was directly supported by the World Bank at the request of the National Treasury's IGR business unit. It was under the project called the City Support Program. So there's a program that directly works with the eight metros in the country. It was led by the IGR division in the Treasury. GTAC support is to provide technical expertise that worked with the World Bank for two reasons. The one is that the kind of support on ease of doing business is a very expensive model to continue to support through the World Bank alone. So GTAC is kind of learning and working alongside by supporting the CSP within the Treasury, and in that way building the kind of competence internal to the country. So the World Bank is still a part of that model, but it continues anyway. I think that's all of it. unless we've forgotten something.
Okay, thanks. It's 1 minute to 2 o'clock. We are supposed to break for lunch. We are supposed to break for lunch and come back at 2 o'clock. Can we do so? Can we break? Where do we have lunch? Upstairs.
Third floor.
Which floor?
Third floor.
Okay.
Is it safe to leave our stuff here? Is someone going to be here?
Yeah, it's safe, I think. We'll make sure that you are available. Yes,
hello. Hello, okay, you good? There it is working. Chair, just before we break, I just wanted to make a very brief follow-up point to the comment made on lifestyle audits. So far as I can see, there's no better organization to actually house this process because you've got unprecedented access into the financial affairs of private individuals, and there's already a sacrifice of privacy because, you know, any transaction above a certain threshold triggers your inquiry system anyway. So, between you and SARS, I think we need to think of a way to get it done, and if it requires legislative changes, then we must bring those changes, and I'm certainly happy to do so, to empower you to do that. But what we cannot do is wait any longer for lifestyle audits to become a norm in South Africa. And the DG has spoken about how DPSA is doing that, but that only applies to civil servants. It doesn't apply to elected office bearers. So we've got to come up with a framework that applies to elective office bearers as well, and if it requires legislative changes, then I'm happy to bring it.
Okay. I think it's a policy matter that can be attended to by the Deputy Minister. Whether you are ready to bring the legislation, private members, please. Okay, Louis. I'm going to just quick follow-up so that we can press for lunch.
But I was saying that perhaps we might need to take a resolution on being given a report on the jobs fund. How many jobs did you create? How much was expended? Who were the beneficiaries of the grants, whatever money was given and everything, so that we were able to monitor that. And I think the issues of the policy positions on procurement we must deal with much more substantially, because outside of what you read, right, there's issues of localization and domestic procurement. I think both manifestos of the black political parties that exist in South Africa, they spoke about a local procurement at 70% and 80% respectively. So we might need to look into that as part of boosting economic growth. It's one of the issues that we might need to look into much more deeply.
Okay, thanks. I think the information in regard to the data on job fund is a matter that the DG can make a follow-up to. On the issue of procurement, I think when Deputy Minister, you come and present the bill, let's seriously engage on the bill. The politics of the bill, so that we don't look at it just technically, it comes here, we comply, but the actual content will be very critical. So thanks very much. The Deputy Minister won't come back. He has got MINCOM. There are many intergovernmental relations budget forums. What is it, MINCOM part or budget council? So MINCOM is something else. MINCOM part.
The Minister's Committee on the Budget.
And this one, what is it?
This one is budget
council.
M9 and
this one is like
MINMEC. Yeah, it's MINMEC.
Okay. Okay, so the Deputy Minister will be attending MINMEC. Thanks very much, Honorable Members. Let's break for lunch and come back at 2.
Thank you.
Is this yours, madam?
Where's my... over and above, which is very good here.
Mm.
Which is very good.
Yeah,
so maybe we could actually have a workshop on this before we actually start.
Yes,
certainly.
Yeah.
Okay.
We can also have a workshop. No, we
have
a when we go to I think it's about the
Oh.